Have you tried Mixtape Massacre, the board game for 80s horror fans? Mixtape Massacre is a tabletop board game where up to six players play as horror film archetypes and compete in a fictional 1986 killing spree to be remembered. Collect kill tokens as you roam the small town of Tall Oaks and stack up your body count, or take each other out of the game in epic brawls. With tons of references to 1980s music, films, and pop culture, Mixtape Massacre will have you laughing while you're slashing. There's even a curated 1980s Mixtape Massacre playlist available on Spotify. Want more? The Black Mask expansion pack arrives this spring, bringing it with more gore, slashers, cards, and gameplay. It's available now at mixtapemassacre.com.
In need of some awesome horror merch, or perhaps the perfect Valentine's Day gift for that special horror-loving person? Head on over to Fright Rags. They have the best collection of horror t-shirts, socks, and other creepy collectibles. Anyway, they use the best horror art drawn by the most renowned horror artists. Now available, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre collection. Also new, the Plastic Fan collection, featuring fun retro-style shirts from Little Monsters, The Running Man, and Video Armageddon. They also have a new Child's Play collection featuring shirts, socks, and enamel pins. You can get 10% off your next order just entering Shockwave0118 at checkout. Visit them online at www.frightrags.com.
Come out and celebrate Women in Horror Month at Film Bar of Phoenix. Women in Horror Month was created to support female genre artists who seek to expose and break down social constructs and miscommunication between female professionals. This February, Film Bar of Phoenix will be showcasing and honoring the works of females in horror with films like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, The Love Witch, and Pet Sematary, along with great panel discussions and guests. In addition to coming together to commend the female voice in horror, they will be supporting some of special nonprofits such as Planned Parenthood, Fresh Start Women's Foundation, and the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship for Women Film, created by Shockwaves and Etheria Film Festival. Continue to make a difference in the lives of women. $3 from every ticket sold will be donated to these organizations. Unite with us and stand for female empowerment through film. For more information, head to www.thefilmbarphx.com. Again, that's www.thefilmbarphx.com.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 82 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
Yeah, man. I haven't been this excited to be on Skype for a long time. It's been a while. We haven't had that Skype guy for a while.
Yeah, the Skype guy.
Well, Rebecca McKendry's here in person.
I was here last week.
Yes, but you're here in person today.
I am here in person.
We still don't know where she was a couple weeks ago.
I'm
we'll
not telling
you. No, we do
either.
Know. We've established that.
Yeah, I guess I was
but returning via Skype, the man, the myth, the legend, Ryan Turek. Welcome, sir.
Hi.
Hey, man.
How are you?
We're good.
And should we warn people there's going to be a lot of spoilers about the new Halloween?
A lot of spoilers about what?
A lot of Halloween spoilers today.
Spoilers. He's just going to reveal the whole plot right
here,
right
now. Coming
all
at you.
The spoilers today. All the
hey,
spoilers.
Ryan, no, you know I what mean, you that... need to make sure you put in the new Halloween movie? I'm just going to start listing things off because I know that's all I see online.
You can can that noise right now.
How's it going, man? I mean, in all sincerity, we're very proud and excited for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's we just wrapped day 13 and we're halfway through, guys.
Halfway. Holy smokes.
Wow.
If you're not on the Instagram or the Facebook, you have to look up the photo of Ryan holding the original slate from a couple days ago. That was a cool photo.
And Laurie Strode on set now.
Oh, yeah.
That was amazing.
Jamie Lee on set. It's very unusual to hear Jamie Lee come on the set and go, Ryan, where's Ryan? I need to ask him a question, and I'm like, "Oh my goodness!"
Was she asking?
I just want
to
keep.
Coffee?
I just want to faint.
I saw. I thought I saw on the Instagrams that Jamie Lee shot with a gun the front cover of the Mondo record.
That is amazing.
As target practice.
She's been in. Yeah, she's been. She's been doing. She's been going to the gun range. And she took David on one day, and then today she just went with her by herself, hung out with some of the same people she hung out with there. And I guess the guy who works at the gun range is a massive Halloween fanatic, and he was like, I've got this Mondo record here. I'm going to take the record out, but I want you to shoot the sleeve.
Oh my God.
And she hit it right in the head.
Yeah. First shot.
That is amazing.
I believe Laurie Strode could take out Michael Myers. No problem.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I didn't know Jamie Lee was into guns.
Yeah.
No, she's not. No. Let's be clear. She's not, but she needs to brush up on this for us.
Okay.
I told you there'd be some big news drop.
Final girl's getting badass.
Bloody Disgusting's going crazy now. Writing that shit up.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. All righty. Well, before we delve into movies we've seen, a lot of news to talk about. We were kind of at the cusp of recording our show, and so we didn't get a chance to mention that, unfortunately, Jack Ketchum is no longer with us.
Yeah,
the great Jack
really
Ketchum. He passed away last week. Real name?
Dallas.
And Dallas Mayer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, he's one of those voices. I don't know if you're familiar with his material. I know all of us can have a recommendation. I started with Peaceable Kingdom, which was a short story collection. And I always think that's a good, I think I did that with Stephen King too. I think maybe Skeleton Key, like that's always a good barometer into an author is if you same thing with Clive Barker, Books of Blood. If, I always think that's a good place to start is so you can get some of their bite-sized voices and see different stories that they do and then delve into their work. But he was one of the most, like, in terms of the darkness of humans, I mean, there is some really effed up stuff across his super
graphic. I mean, like I started off with Off-Season because I think it was when I first moved to Los Angeles and I met Del House in the Dark Delicacies. Mm-hmm. And Del was like, I said, I need recommendations. And the two that I got were Richard Layman and Jack Ketchum. And I had never heard of them, never. And so I said, okay, Jack Ketchum, give me the gnarliest one he has. And I believe Del was the first one to go read Off-Season. Mm. It's a little bit like in the kind of Hills Have Eyes variety. And I read it, man. And I could not believe the descriptions and just the graphic violence I was reading about.
That
I mean, it was just truly, truly just pure base primal shit, man. It was crazy. And then the Girl Next Door. Yeah.
Yeah. And which is also like totally gnarly primal shit as well and just really disturbing. But yeah, Off-Season is the first one I read as well, right? Where I remembered stumbling on that one in high school, like after I'd burned through all the Stephen King books at my local library, like I found that on the horror shelf and read it. And I remember just the gnarly descriptions. I mean, it's obviously got a lot of cannibalism and sex and weird sex and a lot of primal stuff in it with the character Cow. But I remember one specific description where a guy is carrying a severed leg and he spends like a half a page describing the tattoo on the severed leg. And it's just like that type of vividness that it sticks with you.
What about the movies? Because I really liked Red. I actually think as a really, I haven't read Red, but
I haven't seen that in a lot.
I read Red and it's a much more thoughtful, very deeply sad, dramatic piece. But again, it was punctuated by, if I recall, it was really punctuated by a couple of moments of real hardcore violence that just kind of like, upset you. And I said, especially because I mean, this one had to deal with a dog as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the film was very good. Again, it was kind of more of a slow burn. It was a Sundance, definitely like a Sundance movie. And I think I saw it at Sundance. And then the film adaptation of The Girl Next Door. Was it The Girl Next Door?
The Girl Next Door film. That was too much for me. Like I had to turn it off at points.
Yeah.
Is The Lost Ketchum?
The Lost Ketchum.
I love The Lost movie.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And that was the one, Mark Center, who's the lead in that, blew me away. I remember.
That's right.
That was right on the cusp, Anchor Bay, right on the cusp of things like, they were doing like Hatchet and Behind the Mask and like some interesting original movies. And then I saw The Lost. And I just remember that reminded me in tone and spirit of like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
It does.
That was the last time I felt that way with that movie.
Right.
And the lead was Mark Center. Incredible performance for one of his first.
But meeting him in person, because I met him back when we were still doing Fangoria Radio on Sirius, and I was working as a researcher on the show at the time. And because he was local to New York, we had him on a bunch. We would see him around the Fango office all the time. He was just the sweetest guy. I mean, reading his books, you know, they're all very graphic and heavy. He was very sweet. He was very soft-spoken. He loved cats. Just a really sweet guy.
Yeah, I ran into him at the in Las Vegas about a year and a half ago at what was that thing you did, Becca, in Long Beach on the Queen Mary? What was that called?
The Stoker Con.
Yeah, it's a Stoker Con, and he was just a terrific guy to chat with, and just really funny and very sweet. I mean, that's always the case, isn't it, with these authors? Mm-hmm. You know, the stuff that gets poured out of their brains and onto the page is absolutely nothing like their persona.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's a terrible loss. And I mean, for a lot of you that don't know his work, you should definitely get into it. It's worth noting that the last several things he did, he co-wrote with Lucky McKee, mm-hmm. the director of May.
Yeah.
Because they had formed quite an interesting collaboration there.
Well, and they did The Offspring and then
The Woman.
The Woman wasn't based on a book, right? It was their own sequel.
Actually, it was. It was a sequel from The Offspring.
Right.
Because The Woman, original concept from a spinoff of The Offspring, because The Woman herself is a character from
One of the reasons
The Offspring,
better.
Which is off-season.
It's not tied to the literary roots, mm-hmm. you know? It's got a little more freedom there.
Yeah, well.
And gives us hope for Dr. Sleep, because, you know, maybe that will...
There's news. Mike Flanagan is doing Dr. Sleep. Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Also on the news front, I have to say that the promo for the new Purge movie was the best part of the State of the Union.
That was on my list too.
Yeah.
That poster and the teaser on the day that it dropped was, you know what? Hats off to you.
My mom even called me. Yeah. She was like, I didn't know what I was watching. I thought it might be a Coke commercial or maybe an AARP. And then she was just so excited to see Blumhouse on it. So,
now, Rob, imagine the Predator foot slamming on that hat. Now, that's a problem.
I feel like when I saw those materials, I was like, guys, we're just trolling America at this point.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. I loved what Brian Collins posted up on Twitter, which was like, by the time that they get to the Purge 5, it's just going to be called like Purge 5. You know this is about Trump, right?
I mean, why beat around the bush?
I'll tell you one thing I'm not going to do. I am not going to watch or even look at pictures of that Hereditary movie. I'm going to go and buy, because so far I've seen nothing. I saw a little photo of Tony Klett's face, and I'm like, nope, that's all I'm going to ever see.
Keep my ears closed. You're
lucky. I watched the trailer just because it popped up. I was like, hey, look at this. And then everyone's like, don't watch the trailer. And I was like, well, I wish the warning came before they released
Rob,
the trailer.
Rob, you've got 2 days now. Anyone watch the trailer has 2 days to live.
Oh, my God.
But I'm going to try to, I mean, I don't, you know.
Hereditary.
Who picked it up?
I think it's A24 is putting it out later.
Yeah.
Only two choices.
Rye, have you seen it yet?
I have not, but, you know, I just kind of get pissed off when I see people who have seen the movie and go, don't watch the trailer, there's spoiler shit in it. It's like, well, we wouldn't have known that.
Yeah.
We don't know the context of it.
Right. Yeah.
But now we know.
I'm going to call my prediction.
So if it happens to come across my eyeballs, I know.
Prediction now, just based off It Follows, The Witch, and a number of other films, it will get major amounts of hype for being the scariest movie of the year.
I love them.
Many people will love it and say it's the scariest movie of the year, and then there will be a massive backlash of people going, it's not scary. It's going to happen. I'm just waiting for
it. And then 20 years later, it'll still be a great movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because no one cares. But you're right. So far, the A24 model, almost all of them have suffered that.
Yes.
Which is unfair.
It will be what happens. So.
It's just the hype machine.
Well, I was going to say, I can segue this into stuff that we've watched, because I did see a particular Sundance movie that also got a lot of hype.
Okay.
Called Mandy by Panos Cosmatos.
Oh, no spoilers Mandy. Here, or I'll take my cans off. Is it as good as Mom and Dad, Ryan? Is it as good as Mom and Dad?
Dude, we can go gloves off right now on that if you want to.
I love that movie. That was so much fun.
Oh, no.
I had an 80% return rate on that movie. 80% of people agreed with me, Elric, and then one person said he hated it.
Elric, I honestly, if for someone who loves cinema, this movie is like anti-cinema.
But you would say the same thing about the Crank movies, and I love them.
It's pure anti-cinema.
Ryan,
that's your new podcast.
Did you call the Crank movies anti-cinema? Because now we're going to go
to
blows.
Well, also, first off...
I love Crank
movies. First off, no, Crank is great, but that's because it's by two guys, not the one. This one is one half of the Crank team. So
I don't know. I think he's bringing the full Crank universe into this movie. I thought it was cranked up, man.
Mass cranked him.
There was one moment where there was a jump cut, a narrative jump cut, and then I was like, what the hell did you just do, and why did you do that? And I'm so confused by what the fuck I'm watching. Like, it was just, like, so ADD and out of its mind, not in a good way. Anyways,
it's
Mandy,
meant for people with a real elevated aesthetic, Brian. Oh, good Lord. I think you just couldn't quite clear the hurdle of Brian Taylor's mastery.
Let's hear about Mandy.
All right, so Mandy, I mean, as you, I don't know if you guys are reading on it. It's basically, it's set in... the early 80s, Nick Cage is avenging the death of his loved one thanks to a cult leader and his disciples. And it's just pure 70s, 80s, PCP, horror-laden madness. I mean, it is like a fucking 70s horror painting brought to life.
Yeah.
It's like one part, like, there's like moments of animation. There's moments of just pure abstract visuals. There's moments of just great grindhouse sleaze.
How does it compare to Beyond the Black Rainbow aesthetically? Like,
completely,
is it pretty similar?
Dude, it's completely different. I mean, like, wow. Aesthetically, Beyond the Black Rainbow was a ramp up to something like this. Mm-hmm. I feel like Panos. You know, narratively, I mean, like, when you strip all of the style away,
yeah,
it's a really basic story. We've seen the story thousands of times.
Yeah.
But all of the elements that he threw into it, all the weird side characters and the kind of esoteric ramblings of the cult leader and all of that. And then, of course, Nicolas Cage's madness, you know, it just lent itself to a really, really cool, memorable movie. My only problem with it is just the runtime. I mean, like, it's 120 minutes, and I'm just like, this easily could have been 90 minutes long, man.
Do you think that's the final cut, or do you think it could still?
No, I think it's definitely the final cut. I think it's the final cut. I mean, like, and the soundtrack is great. I really dug it. I watched it like on a really early morning, and that shit woke me up fast.
Yeah.
Wow. It was cool. Yeah, you'll dig it, man. You'll dig it. I think everybody will dig it, actually.
And so it's good, Nick Cage.
It's good. Yes. Thank God.
That's all that matters.
Good
Nick Cage.
Yes.
That's what we need more of in this world.
Well, now I know. I can throw Nick Cage on a slab of bread and you'll appreciate it.
It's really, I avoid a lot of those really generic looking ones. But if he gets to go uncut, I like it. I'll admit it's a weakness.
You like full cage weird.
I like full cage.
Yeah.
Uncut Cage.
Uncut Cage, baby.
On a loaf of bread.
That's going to be our next podcast. We can do every Cage movie in order.
Wow.
Let's do it.
Why don't we jump in? I know. Obviously, last week we had Severin on, David Greger from Severin, which was a great fun chat. And I got to dig into the Amicus box set. I think Elric, you've seen some Severin stuff as well.
Oh yeah.
So why don't we start with Severin?
Yeah.
What did you see? You're making a face. I know you've been waiting.
I mean, this is the one he gave us all some discs when he came because he's a very nice man, David Greger, and he said, "Oh, you need this one," and he passed me this movie. Okay. So this is Intervision, so you already know it's my bag. This is one of the movies you'll see only get one of these a year.
Right. Intervision is all shot on video stuff, yes.
When it's truly holy fucking shit. Okay? So this isn't holy fucking shit in the way Devil's Honey is, where there's something about it I love and keep it. This is just like, oh my God, I can't believe this exists. Okay, so imagine the setup, right? Ready? Okay, so first, imagine that Tommy Wiseau slept with Billy Drago. And somehow spawned a child who literally just looks like the two of them combined.
Wow.
And then you put him in a Saw movie with no budget. And that is Beyond the Seventh Door. And I mean, the guy looks exactly, his acting style is as bad as Tommy Wiseau, but he looks a little bit more like Billy Drago. His name is Lazar Rockwood.
Amazing name.
I'm looking him up.
And it's
right
basically
now.
An ex-convict gets out of jail in the opening scene, and he goes to meet his ex-lover, who happens to be a French maid at a mansion. And he's like, "Look, baby, we can go in there, do one more crime, and then we get out. We're out after
Does
that.
Does he
we're
have
out.
The same
you know?
Accent?
Yeah, it's a crazy accent. No, it's crazy. And his character name is Boris. So you can't. I think it says he's from Lithuania. Anyway, he talks to her, and she's kind of giving a hard time.
Oh, my God. It really looks like Billy Drago and Tommy Wiseau had a love child.
Yeah, exactly. If you ever look up worst performances, there's like a really funny reel of, and there's a clip from this movie showed up. So I had seen a clip from this movie. I just didn't know what the movie was.
Right.
And now I've seen the movie.
Now you've seen the whole thing.
And so then he goes in to rob this place. He says, "Okay, you go outside. upstairs, do your thing. I'll come in and we'll get the. So they go downstairs to rob this place. And then basically a door closes and a voiceover thing goes, you have come to rob me and now you will be in my game. And basically it's floor to floor, exactly like Saw, where each floor, like walls start closing.
They have to come up with
a way to break like a kind of a riddle that is given to them by the voice to get to the end. And it's kind of got a bit of that morality play of, you know, the choices he will make will decide whether he gets to survive or not. But it's shot on video. So this is SOV Saw before Saw with basically Tommy Wiseau. I mean,
I really want to see this man's skull. Like, yeah. I've never said that before in my life, but just look at his bone structure.
That's Rebecca's pickup line. Yeah.
I really want to see your skull.
I'm
look
really
at his bone structure.
Right,
I just really want to see his skull. It's fascinating.
1987.
It's on Amazon Prime as well, but the version on there isn't like doesn't look as good as the DVD. Because I had started on there and then just realized, oh, I'll watch the desk. I was having problems playing it at one point. It's also a bit like The Collector, the actual story. I feel like there's quite a lot of, but imagine those with like no budget. So, I mean, it's actually kind of charming. This will probably play gangbusters as a party film, but watching it alone, you're going to feel weird.
Now, do we suspect that a young James Wan and Lee Winnell may have rented this movie?
I'm 100% they just 80s? Ripped off. They owe everything to a man called Lazar Rockwood.
Wow.
No, it's a weird one, but I think it's definitely fun. Like, I cannot say this is a good movie by any means, but I could definitely say that no matter what, you'd be entertained. You couldn't be bored watching this thing. Just the performances are batshit, you know?
You know who's a big fan of this movie, by the way? Ryan, do you want to chime in? Because this is a movie your fiance had gushed to me about recently.
Apparently.
She's a huge fan.
This is what happens when I'm gone.
Yes. Oh, man. She's and a Lazar Rockwood girl.
I had to promise not to watch it without her, because apparently that's how much she loved it and she'd like to watch it again. So
wow.
We have a Beyond the Seventh Door movie night coming up.
No, I mean, that's the hard part with like SOV and Intervision stuff is like getting the right one. So I think you could get five films and be like, kind of boring. This one won't disappoint on that level. But you have to be at that level in the same way Things doesn't disappoint to me.
Right. Yeah.
But
right.
It was crazy. Crazy movie.
Wow.
Well, speaking amazing. Of Severin, I delved into the Amicus box set and... I hadn't seen any of these films except Asylum, which I saw back for Halloween this year. But the first one, The Beast Must Die. I'm a huge werewolf fan. Yeah. This is from 1974. I've never seen it. Peter Cushing's in it. And he was telling, David Gregory was telling us last week that this was not one, the elements are lost for this one. But they did do an HD scan back whenever the last DVD was. So this looks good. It doesn't look great, but it looks pretty good for what it is. The movie itself... It's really interesting. Had I seen this at 12, I would have loved it tremendously. But now that I'm an adult and I've seen so many werewolf movies and kind of stuff like that, it's more the gimmick is more fun than the actual movie. So the movie is pretty decent. It's basically all these people are up at this giant mansion, and the guy that owns the property is kind of this he's a little eccentric and insane, and he's keeping them all there because he's convinced that one of them is a werewolf, and he's not going to let any of them go until he figures it out. But what's great about it is you, the audience, get to participate. There is a werewolf break. I think it's 25, 30 minutes before the end. It pauses with a little clock that ticks for 30 seconds, and it says, who do you think is the werewolf?
Ooh.
And it shows each character pop up again. And so
that's totally like a Mr. Sardonicus move.
It's really fun. Like that part of it's fun. And so from that moment to like, cause there's fun stuff throughout, but from that moment to the end, it just goes all bonkers because now they're trying to, you know, throw you off on who it might be. And then they reveal the identity and then, you know, it's not what you think. And it was kind of the gimmick of it was cool. The thing with me is when it comes to werewolves, I like werewolves to be like wolf men.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, it's right on the cover of the box. It's a wolf.
It's a beast.
So it turns into an actual wolf. And that always disappointed me in werewolf movies. Even as a kid, I liked it to be a monster, not just a wolf, not just a good-looking, cute dog.
Yeah.
So
it's a movie I feel like if you were remaking the idea and it was super R-rated and the effects are great, you could make a really cool movie out of that idea. But it definitely dragged. I remember watching it back in the day going, oh, yeah, is that all it is? You know?
Yeah, so it's great, but it drags a little bit. But I'll tell you, the standout in the set was And Now the Screaming Starts from
1973. Cool, because I put it on my shelf and I was deciding whether to jump in.
It's great.
Okay,
because I started with The Beast Must Die and I was like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good, you know, like kind of what it is. But, you know, sometimes you never know with, like, Hammer or British Horror. Mm-hmm. Like, is it going to be a little slow or boring, whatever? No, this one kicks right off with kind of a, like, there's this great scare with this ghost-like hand-looking thing. And basically, this guy is just married, comes back to live in his old house, and the woman keeps seeing kind of like this rogue hand, like, you know, kind of just crawling around and trying to get her. And then she sees the rest of the guy, which is a guy with his eyes gouged out that just kind of appears in the windows and stuff.
Wow.
And so, you know, slowly but surely they start unraveling that there's some sort of family curse there. Mm. And so you're trying to figure out exactly what the identity is. But the thing moved really well and had some cool scares and really interesting sequences. And even the effects for 1973, like a guy without any eyeballs and like a missing hand was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And it gets pretty nasty. Like by the end of it, when everything kind of resolves itself, you're like, oh man, it's kind of one of the nastier horror movies of this era. Of course, Peter Cushing's in it. He's amazing. And when one of the guys from Clockwork Orange, he's in a bunch of these Amicus movies. So a lot of familiar faces, and it was actually kind of a pleasant surprise and a fun little gem of this set. So,
something to look forward to, because I was looking at it going, I don't think I've seen it, because I was thinking House of Drip Blood when I looked at the cover.
Oh, right, which is another great one.
Yeah, that's a good one. But that's an anthology. This one isn't, right?
No, this is not an anthology. Yeah. It's just a straightforward narrative, and it is a pleasant surprise and a great title, and Now the Screaming Starts.
Oh, yeah, great. That's a great title, yeah.
So definitely recommend that.
Nice.
Becca.
Okay, so I did contemporary stuff this week because I'm trying to catch up on things that I may have missed over the past couple of weeks. So I watched The Vault on Netflix. This is the new film that was released straight to Netflix with Franco on it.
Oh, James Franco, yeah.
So really cool premise. Like, I had really high hopes for this movie. I hadn't heard much about it going in, but it just popped up on my feed, and I was like, that's a cool idea. Group of people break into a bank and are trying to find money, and they end up breaking into this vault. And then something is in the vault that is very sinister, and then everything goes haywire from there. And I won't blow too much of that. There is, you find out at the very top, that this particular bank that they are breaking into has this like crazy history where in the 70s, or it may have been the 80s, somebody broke in and took like 10 people hostage and ended up killing all of them and like set them all on fire while they were still alive. So you find out from the get-go that this bank has some pretty sinister history. So I thought the setup was great. Where the movie completely fell apart was it gets really lazy on the horror. Like, the heist stuff is good. I was in with it, with the characters. Franco was, it's weird because I never have said this about a single other project, but they underused Franco. Wow. Usually, if anything, I'm like, this has a bit too much Franco in it.
He probably gave them a day.
Yeah, and so it kind of felt like Franco was being underused in this one, where I felt like he should have been doing a bit more. But that said, once it gets to the actual horror of the vault, then it gets lazy. The mythology wasn't clearly thought out. There were some plot holes where I was, Ryan, are you brushing your teeth?
We heard some noises.
We heard
some questionable noises.
I'm just
going to
assume you're brushing your teeth during the podcast.
I just ate dinner while you were talking.
We have sound effects in this one, guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, so as soon as they get to the actual vault, there's like the mythology doesn't really pan out. They don't really explain things. Some supernatural things that shouldn't really coexist together do. There's questions about if it has to stay in the vault or can it go out to the middle of a field, and it gets a little lazy at that point. I liked the first half, and then when the horror showed up, I was like, oh, this just went way downhill. That said, when I was researching it and looking after the fact, like I typed it in my letterbox, everyone loves this thing. I saw a couple people who were kind of like, the horror is not good in it. But I saw a lot of reviews that were like, this is really underrated. Why haven't people been watching it?
Funny you mentioned the horror part of it, because I just investigated. Because I saw this pop up on Netflix, and I was curious about it. This was directed by Dan Bush, who is one of
the
three
Signal.
Directors of The Signal, 2007.
That's a name I haven't heard since then.
I know, yeah. He did the third segment, which kind of goes straight for drama as opposed to horror. So
that's what this
kind of
does,
funny,
too.
That you mentioned that. But no, it's ironic because Dan Bush did this one, and now David Bruckner, the other Signal director, is doing The Ritual, which is also going to be a Netflix original.
Oh,
the trailer just popped
soon.
Up. Yeah.
So this one, I mean, it's definitely got some mixed reviews on Letterboxd and IMDb. I will say there are parts of it that I liked. There were some decent scares, but yeah, the horror, it felt a bit lazy for me. But yeah, it's on Netflix, so watch it for yourself and see what you think and let us know.
But it was worth watching for you? You thought it was good enough to?
It was better than a lot of the other stuff I would have watched. So yeah, it was better than.
You can say that a lot.
That was a Becca slam by Becca. I'm going to be out of a job if this continues.
No, it was better than many of the other selections I think I would have made on Netflix. So it at least kept me entertained the whole way through. And even when I thought that the horror got lazy, I never once felt like I needed to turn it off. I always wanted to see where it was going.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Ryan, did you have time to squeeze anything else in?
Yeah, actually, I caught up on a bunch of things. I mean, like, it's stuff that you guys have covered. I was just playing catch up. I saw Jigsaw, finally.
Okay, what's your...
Game changer, right?
Yeah.
What's your two-sentence
synopsis?
Elric
and I watched it last week.
Jigsaw... I mean, like, I don't know what the point of the story was, because it just felt like more of the same.
But less.
Especially when the revelation came around. What?
More but less. But less.
That's what Elric and I both said, is it felt less busy Saw movie.
Oh, God, what are you kidding me? I mean, like, there was so much shit happening in this movie. I was just like, I needed, like, a map to keep track of, like, okay, the mortician, the doctor, the cop.
Yeah, but
cop
we didn't
partner.
Care about the cops and the morticians and the doctor.
You never care.
Yeah,
no,
that was
care.
The whole point.
You never care about anybody in these movies, mm-hmm. you know, except for Jigsaw. And I was just like, okay. I mean, like, I would, like, just kind of find how many times I'd pick up my phone just to check email quick, and then some cool shit would happen. I do got to say, I mean, like, I loved a lot of the traps, and I liked a lot of the, you know, the flaying. Mm-hmm. And then the big finale comes up, and I was kind of like, huh? Wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just very weird. I mean, like, it just felt like more of the same, and it could have come out, you know... 3 years ago, and I would have been like, okay, closer to like the last film release, whatever. I saw Shape of Water.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I thought thought it was a very beautiful film. Thought it was very good. I thought it was, you know, I thought that, you know, Guillermo did a great job. It's definitely one of my more favorite Guillermo movies. Mm-hmm. I had a weird experience, though. Let me just share this with you guys. So, I mean, like, listen, it's been out for a while. I could drop a little spoiler.
Not Richard Jenkins, in the UK yet, though.
Richard Jenkins has an affection for someone in the film.
Yes.
And he shows that to another man. And there was a woman in my audience who legitimately gasped. And I was like, oh, man, she's like feeling this movie. She's like, really? Okay. That was like a gasp of sympathy and empathy, you know. And all of a sudden I see her immediately get up, grab her husband, and walk out the door.
Wow.
What?
And I was like, wow. And I wanted to shout, but you're okay with the fish fucking? Yeah. But she was already gone. It made me so fucking sad and infuriated that she was like, that was the one mic drop moment for her, with that she was just like, this is insulting.
You know,
anyways,
fish fucking
just,
totally.
Really, Yeah. I was just like, okay, you're completely fine with interspecies sex. Great. But it was really, I thought like Sally Hawkins did a phenomenal job. I thought Richard Jenkins, guys, national treasure.
Everything he touches turns to gold, really.
Every single thing he does is amazing. From Cabin in the Woods, Flirting with Disaster.
Let Me In. I mean, he's amazing in Let Me In. I mean, he makes that movie. That's why it's almost as good as the original.
He totally does.
Yeah, he's so
good. I mean, like, good God, man. I would love to get him on the show and just, like, pick his brain about every single thing.
Not to mention Bone Tomahawk. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
He is the best. I mean, God, he could have got an Oscar nom for that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. But he definitely elevated the movie for me. I think Michael Shannon did a great job. Michael Shannon being Michael Shannon.
Yeah, they could have made him more complex. I feel like Michael Shannon's great, but he gets to play the one note.
Yeah,
he skirts it. He skirts the moments of brilliance. There are some like really really good moments where Michael Shannon moments that we hadn't seen before. But then, like, it just kind of, he kind of slides back into the norm, you know?
The stuff with the fingers is great, though. His fingers rotting is so great.
But it was very good. It's a great, I thought it was a very good movie. So much better than Crimson Peak, and it definitely left a lasting taste in my mouth, and I'm still thinking about the film. So, you know, I think that it was very good. So those were the other two I got to catch up on. And I watched Asylum out of the box set, out of the Amicus box set. I had that shipped to me here. Asylum is really just a blast and a gem of an anthology movie, but I watched the making of afterward. I don't know if you watched that.
No, I haven't gotten the features yet.
Yeah, there was a great kind of EPK promo piece about it, and it's like Milton Sablotsky, who was a New Yorker living in England, and it was just interesting to see him. Like, wow. it's them on the, in their studio, and it's like here in the bungalow on the soundstage, la da 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 da, you know, and it was like, here's Milton, and he's like just a dude surrounded by books, and he was like a producer I completely look up to, because he's like, I read so many books a year. I read so many scripts, and I'm just like, yeah. I wish I could read that much. but he had like all of these like pulpy paperbacks, like really like, you know, like kind of crime fiction, horror fiction, all sitting on a shelf. And I just kind of admired that kind of, you know, love for cinema and being a producer. That was really cool. But I got halfway through that making of, and I put a little pin in it. I'll go back and watch it. Yeah, but no, it's cool.
Yeah, no, it is wonderful. I actually forgot that was on the check disc that I got a couple of months ago, and I watched it because it's period. It's a documentary of that time.
It was made then. It was made in 1970, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's super fascinating to hear him talk about, like, you know, oh, we just got somebody in for 2 days and then we got another pitcher. Or, you know, the idea of making shorts was because it was easier to get bigger name talent.
Of course, yeah, that's great.
For a day or two, and now you have all these names in your movie. It's why they focus on anthology so much.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Hold
on, Ryan, we have a call waiting. Gotta just swipe you over.
I have to use my actual phone has to be used to record to Skype Ryan in. And so, I get our guests calling us while we're at that. I just got one more movie left that I wanted to talk about. I know, Ryan, you revisited this a couple of months ago. I got the Warner Archive.
It's not Silent Hill 2?
No.
I loved seeing the debates.
Wait, didn't you love that, Ryan?
This week.
That was a bit. You're a huge fan of that one, right?
We resolved that on Twitter. It's totally fine.
The Twitter feed was hilarious to watch. It was just one of those things.
Alternate world. Ryan Turek really loves Silent Hill Revelation.
It shows what happens when you're out of town. We can smear you like.
Jesus.
I wasn't going to go back and listen to the episode whenever we talked about it.
I will say, I did meet with that filmmaker, and she is incredible. Like, just completely charmed me. And you know, she kind of admitted that Silent Hill wasn't the best thing, but you know, I'm very eager to see what she's got cooking next, and we're going to continue talking to see if we can find the right project.
Okay.
That's
great. You heard it here first. Scoop right there. Yeah.
That was scoop.
No, scoop. It's not a scoop.
We're just teasing. But the film I was talking about was Warner Archives' release of Innocent Blood on Blu-ray, the John Landis movie from 1992. I haven't seen this since I was that age, since it came out initially. And my memory back then was that I kind of liked it. I remember, like, there were things I liked about it, things I didn't. I mean, the lead who plays Marie, the French actress, and... Parlade? Who is the original Nikita?
Uh-huh.
Is
the film Nikita, yeah.
By far one of the most gorgeous women ever. And I remember as a kid being like, "Who's that? She's amazing." And then the other thing is, you know, here's the thing: I still like the movie. There's a few things wrong with it though that were much more clear to me now as an adult, because I do love John Landis's style, and it seems like his attempt to redo An American Werewolf in London, trying to get that horror and comedy blend. But the first thing is, this movie's a half hour too long, because it is 2 hours on the dot. I'm kind of like, oh my God, like total half hour, this could be taken out. Number two, he tries a little too hard on the comedy side. The thing that works so beautifully about American Werewolf in London is they're not playing things for laughs. They're playing it real. And because it's real, it's funny. Whereas this one, the moments that work are the ones that they are playing straight, like kind of the way that these mobsters, because basically it's a vampire infiltrates these mobsters, starts feeding on them, but she doesn't kill one. And so now a bunch of mobsters are turning into vampires as well. Totally funny premise on paper. But that's the thing is, like, when it tries to be funny, it goes a little overboard with that. And part of the thing that connects to that I notice now that I'm much more cognizant of music is the score does not match at all. Yeah. It's kind of got, and I get it, it's got that zany, almost like, you know, that kind of like zany, like gangster comedy style thing that like Landis probably loves from classic movies, but the score doesn't work at all. And I'm like, oh, this makes the tone so weird. And lastly, as much as I loved Anne growing up, she is not the right person for this role because she can barely speak English. And so it is really hard when your lead vampire is the main, the who has most of the dialogue, doesn't really speak well English.
Speak well
when
English.
When you have Don
English
Rickles, well? What do you, what does
Don
matter?
Rickles, what do you need?
He's
you,
great at him and Loggia. They're both great.
Loggia, I mean, that's it. The,
Rickles
the,
kills me when
And
he
again,
turns.
I don't mean to harp on this movie's negatives. It's just that there's so much good in it that I wish it was a leaner, uh-huh. a leaner, much more, you know, concise movie. Loggia's amazing in it. He's the head gangster. I mean, the whole cast, you'd recognize everybody. It's the guy that from The Sopranos is in it. You know, Chaz, what's the Chaz?
Palamentary.
He's in the beginning of it. There's so many great people. Kim Coates, you know, so a lot of recognizable faces. And really the cherry on the icing is basically all the cameos. So obviously Dario Argento's in there.
Oh,
Sam
I didn't remember Argento.
Oh, Dario Argento is he's a cab driver.
Oh,
no, he's
yeah,
a cab
Savini,
driver.
I remember. Oh. But
Savini's the paparazzi. They're like, hey, go that's get that right, piece yeah. of shit. And he's like, and you look at it, Savini. And he's like, oh. And he like runs away and you're like, so that's
wow,
kind of funny.
I'm looking at it now. Frank Oz is the pathologist.
Yes. Frank Oz.
Forey Ackerman steals a car.
Forey Ackerman's in there. Wow. He gets the car stolen from him by Loggia.
Sam Raimi
attempting his best at a New York accent, and it's terrible.
It's Roma meets man is yes. what he's credited as.
He actually says to Loggia, you want me to call somebody boss? Like,
oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Oh, Steve Johnson's in there.
Steve
Linnea
Johnson
Quigley.
Did the effects, and so he pops up in it wow. as well.
Yeah. I remember the eyes being really freaky. I have not seen this yes. movie since I was a kid, but I remember the eyes being really freaky when
yeah,
I was
there's,
a kid.
Yeah, there's cool stuff to it. Steve Johnson there's a moment where a vampire blows up in the sun that I remember. It's not nearly as good as the Werewolf Transformation, obviously, but it's really good effect-wise. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's a pretty standout effect right there. And so I like this movie more than I don't, but that's the thing that bums me out is there's so much to it that's kind of like, oh, man, cut out a half hour and maybe recast this lead. And
part of her problem might not just be her, though. It could also be being cast opposite Anthony LaPaglia. Like, together they might not have worked. Because LaPaglia is great, but he is Australian, and that's early days for him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he's trying to play a gangster, and he's from Australia. You know, it's...
Yeah.
It's all chemistry.
Yeah,
totally.
I got a couple fun ones from the 80s, 1988. I hadn't seen this in a long time. The slasher film Out of the Dark. It popped up on Vudu. You'd remember it's the call center where they're doing the sex role playing phone center of these like various women who do it, and slowly they're being knocked off by a guy wearing a clown mask called Bobo. And this is one I saw on TV, and I had forgotten I'd seen it. But then as soon as it started, I was like, oh, yeah, you can't forget this one. It's really trashy. Like, it is really misogynistic, and really just everything about it feels sleazy. But it's really still fun. Bud Cort, who was, you know, one of my favorite actors, Harold from Harold and Maude, plays one of the possible suspects who could be dressing as the clown. It's got a ridiculous last, like, 20 minutes, like, to the point where you're like, oh, come on. Like, you know, it's a pretty silly movie, but if it pops back up. I don't know if that means there's an HD master out there. I was watching on a platform called Vudu, but it was just fun to watch again. I love that time period, but it's got every slasher cliche in the book. Like, literally, it's a film structured on cliche.
And that was what again, the title?
Out of the Dark.
Out of the Dark.
From 1988.
Which I didn't remember the title. That's where I went wrong. It's like, oh, I've seen the film. And then another one I hadn't really remembered I'd seen is, and we're all talking, everyone was writing how it was on TCM Underground, but that's Razorback.
I used to love that one.
As soon as it started, I was like, oh, yeah. I've seen Razorback probably more, you know, growing up in that part of the world, I've probably certain number of times. But what struck me watching it this time, whilst it's not a great movie by any means, Russell Mulcahy, who would obviously go on to do Highlander, you can really see how he got that gig from this, because he takes something probably on a pretty low, you know, shoestring budget, and at every point tries to make it look like a giant Hollywood movie. And even the lighting design reminds you a lot of Near Dark in the kind of things they're doing, in these kind of almost surrealist lighting approach, and it just feels bigger than it should be. There's a lot of really bad characterization, like the two kind of rapey punks who just happen to live in the outback, which does not exist in Australia. They really kind of bothered me. But when the giant pig or boar is going into action, it's always fun, and it's like it's a fun to see a director probably got his break, and this kind of teed that up pretty nicely, which is fun. Yeah. And just, yeah, you're a fan of that one?
I remember seeing this one when I was a kid, and the part that I specifically remember is he finds his wife's wedding ring in a pile of poop.
Yep.
And then he realizes that the pig ate her.
Yeah.
And I loved that moment.
I mean, it opens with a pig, like, killing a baby. I mean, you don't see the baby die.
It's
brutal.
My dad would show me that. I remember he got the Japanese Laserdisc because it was the only way you can get a letterbox version of it. And I just remember one day he was like, just watch the first 5 minutes. I'm going to show you the first 5 minutes. And I was just like, wow, did the giant pig just steal a baby? I mean, like.
Yeah, that was the best part of the film. That was the best sequence. It's really well made. And the house is on fire. It's a fun Outback movie. And it reminds me a bit of George Miller's early ability to craft something from a low budget, but make it feel bigger. And that's not everyone can do that.
Yeah.
And just to end, because I know we're probably running out of time, I got to give a shout out to an album I've been listening to a lot right now, because it really surprises me where it comes from. It's the Pilot Priest album that Waxwork released called Original Motion Picture Soundtrack. And I've been playing this stuff nonstop at work. But what's cool about it, it is the director of my favorite segment by far of the Holidays film, Father's Day, Anthony Scott Burns. And this thing is, I mean, it's the fact that he's also a musician with this kind of capability. It's like perfect synth, Carpenter-esque scores. And each one has, what are some of the titles? It's like the title tracks on this album are things like Body
titles.
Double and After Hours, Miracle Mile. It's literally like a lineup of the movies we talk about on Pure Cinema. It's like all our favorite kind of movies. So
it's a lot of music too. It's terrific.
It is.
And
it was like
lot
2 hours 20. Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Pilot Original Priest. Motion Picture Soundtrack. But that's this is Anthony Scott Burns' side label. But he had sent me this record, like, I don't know, it was like when he first. He heard us talking about Father's Day, and he sent me this record. I didn't get around to listening to it recently, and now I'm just like over the moon, like, oh my God, this is so good.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for his feature, because I've heard he's up there shooting a feature up in Canada.
That's
so
terrific.
I got
this record from Waxworks as well, because they have the vinyl version, but you can find Pilot Priest on Bandcamp.
Okay.
And I believe it's pretty much free. It's like a name your own price deal.
Yeah, cool.
And so immediately after I listened to the record, I was like, you know what? I kind of want this digitally too. And it is a tremendous amount of music. So even if you kick $5 or $10, you could find Pilot Priest on Bandcamp. And I strongly recommend this
album.
That's
terrific.
I hope he scores
really great.
Some other people's movies really cool. too, as well as his own stuff, because it's great.
Yeah.
Well, I have two really quick ones that I'll do. I watched Geostorm. Which I have
that's
been...
not at all surprising. That is like a movie
I would
have seen
course,
opening day.
This is like
okay,
the most...
guys, I think that's a wrap for me.
You're
out.
Lion's out of Geostorm.
Yeah, so I usually love disaster movies. I pretty much love anything with giant explosions. And this, I mean, it's a slippery horror genre thing, but pretty much like I've always been amused by how if it's a natural disaster, people are like, oh, it's a tidal wave. That's action. But if it's a swarm of locusts or Godzilla, people are like, oh, well, that's horror. So I still kind of equate these with horror, and I still love them just the same way that I would any horror movies that do the same thing. So Geostorm, there were billboards for this all over Burbank. So I was expecting a giant movie. Plus the thing cost $120 million to make. And it's directed by Dean Devlin, who had produced Stargate and all the Independence Day films and the Godzilla movies, the American ones, and Eight-Legged Freaks. So I was like, this is going to be huge. Oh my God. It was so the whole setup of it is that we're in the near future and global warming became a problem. So they create all these satellites to control the Earth's weather. But then someone gets control of the satellites and starts doing crazy shit like lighting Tokyo on fire. And, you know, all of these global disasters start happening. And they realize that if, you know, you're controlling it like this, that eventually it will cause a geostorm where it's like this giant storm that's going to like destroy the whole world. And you would think that with a movie named Geostorm that you would eventually get the geostorm. Don't plan on that.
No.
And then the whole reason that someone decided to take over the satellite system and literally kill millions of people is quite possibly the dumbest rationale I've ever seen in a movie. So yeah, that was Geostorm. So if you're thinking of watching Geostorm, stop yourself right there and instead watch The Wave is really good. That's the Norwegian disaster movie that came out 2 years ago. I loved that one. Miracle Mile is great. Yeah, I really enjoyed San Andreas, Deep Impact, Towering Inferno. There are many options you can find aside from this. There was a funny part where Ed Harris pulls a rocket launcher out of a car trunk. That one was a kind of amusing moment, but the rest of it I was just kind of bored by.
You should see The Tower, the Korean movie The Tower from a couple of years ago.
The Tower?
It's basically South Korea's loose remake of The Towering Inferno. I saw it at the Korean theater when it played. It's pretty insane. If you can imagine a modern version of The Towering Inferno, but these Korean stories always have really kind of sad and fucked up things happening.
They always have really crazy drama.
Yeah, there's drama, comedy, and then really dark shit in the middle of it all.
Look what they live next door to.
Well,
I think that's where the darkness comes.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's called The Tower, one.
And then the other thing I rewatched Happy Death Day, which I had seen at a Wednesday afternoon matinee when it was running back last year. And since the Blu-ray came out, I was kind of like, let's rewatch this. This was really fun. It is just as fun the second time, even more so because you know where some of it's going. And usually when it's a movie like that, like the Sixth Sense, I always thought, it's not going to be as good on the second viewing because you kind of know where it's going and some of the cool little things. This got better because suddenly I was seeing all of these things that he built into it and things that I hadn't caught the first time. So I highly recommend, if you haven't seen Happy Death Day, check it out. And if you've seen it already, watch it a second time. It's just as cool.
The movie I issued an apology for.
Right.
I issued a recount of my top 10.
Was that when you saw it a second time?
I just was thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, I was like, why did I leave that off? That's one of the most fun movies.
Yeah, it was my number three.
Okay, Elric, can you put that in writing, leave it on my desk?
Put it on the poster. But I'm not changing my mind. I'm Mom and Dad, baby. I'm in. I'm sticking to my guns. Brian Taylor.
We'll talk in December 28th.
I want to see that one on your top 10
list. It's going to steal my number 10 spot. Hey, it's my number one of 2018 so far, and we're 20 days in.
All righty. Well, thanks, gang, and thanks, Ryan, for checking in.
All right, guys.
And don't fuck up the ending.
Shut up. Well, I'll look at the schedule next week, and maybe I'll jump back on.
Cool.
But we're going to be switching over to nights very soon.
And then when are you officially back, so everyone would hear you in the flesh?
Mid-February, right?
Probably the week of February 18th.
All right.
Cool.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Ryan. We'll check in with you next week.
See you later.
Ciao.
And we'll hear from our sponsors. And then we have a very special guest, which will complete our podcast crossover. I'm very excited for this one.
But you maybe want to watch Psycho and Exorcist first.
Yes. Right now.
Right now.
Have you tried Mixtape Massacre, the board game for 80s horror fans? Mixtape Massacre is a tabletop board game where up to 6 players play as horror film archetypes and compete in a fictional 1986 killing spree to be remembered. Collect kill tokens as you roam the small town of Tall Oaks and stack up your body count or take each other out of the game in epic brawls. With tons of references to 1980s music, films, and pop culture, Mixtape Massacre will have you laughing while you're slashing. There's even a curated 1980s Mixtape Massacre playlist available on Spotify. Want more? The Black Mask expansion pack arrives this spring, bringing it with more gore, slashers, cards, and gameplay. It's available now at mixtapemassacre.com.
In need of some awesome horror merch or perhaps the perfect Valentine's Day gift for that special horror-loving person? Head on over to Fright Rags. They have the best collection of horror t-shirts, socks, and other creepy collectibles. Anyway, they use the best horror art drawn by the most renowned horror artists. Now available, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre collection. Also new, the Plastic Fan collection, featuring fun retro-style shirts from Little Monsters, The Running Man, and Video Armageddon. They also have a new Child's Play collection featuring shirts, socks, and enamel pins. You can get 10% off your next order just entering Shockwave0118 at checkout. Visit them online at www.frightrags.com.
Come out and celebrate Women in Horror Month at Film Bar of Phoenix. Women in Horror Month was created to support female genre artists who seek to expose and break down social constructs and miscommunication between female professionals. This February, Film Bar of Phoenix will be showcasing and honoring the works of females in horror with films like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, The Love Witch, and Pet Sematary, along with great panel discussions and guests. In addition to coming together to commend the female voice in horror, they will be supporting some of special nonprofits such as Planned Parenthood, Fresh Start Women's Foundation, and the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship for Women Film, created by Shockwaves and Etheria Film Festival. Continue to make a difference in the lives of women.
$3 from every ticket sold will be donated to these organizations. Unite with us and stand for female empowerment through film. For more information, head to www.thefilmbarphx.com. Again, that's www.thefilmbarphx.com.
Okay, and welcome back. And leaving January and going into February, this is the end of our podcast crossover idea, at least for now. It's been pretty fun. We got to do the TV show at Punch Drunk TV. Mick Garris was on for Postmortem. And then we took a diversion with David Gregory from Severance so he could announce The Changeling.
Which and Bria. He should have Bria. His own
Bria was
podcast.
Here. Yes, yes. Yeah. But this was one that I thought up and decided, you know, this would be a fun guest because I discovered Inside Psycho on Wondery, obviously because I'm a psycho guy, and it was not hard for me to stumble upon that show. And then the gentleman behind the show followed up with Inside the Exorcist, which I told Elric about just as it was coming on, and our listeners. And a lot of people jumped on right about then, which was nice because then I think Inside Psycho kind of repeated, and then some bonus episodes and all that. And again, it's a very unique show in the sense that it's not exactly biographical, it's not exactly narrative, it's an interesting combination of all of it, which I've never heard before. And it made Inside the Exorcist a really, even though I knew a lot of bits and pieces, hearing it, you know, told that way was really exciting. And so with us is the narrator and creator of these shows, Inside Psycho and Inside the Exorcist.
Narrator, creator, host. Bon vivant, everything but gentleman. I have to take exception to that.
Mark Ramsey is here with us, everybody.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. It's fun to see what you guys look like in the flesh.
You know what? I was saying the same right before you walked in. I was like, yeah, he looks like what I think he would look like because I listen to the show, obviously, and I'm so used to you doing not only that, but all these character voices because you are everybody on
the
show.
You do character voices
on
the show?
No, they're not character voices. They're just, you
it's
know,
his voice, but as the character.
Yeah. I intentionally stayed away from character voice. The idea with the series, both of them, is that it's intended to be kind of audiographic novel is what I call it. So, I mean, the idea is that it's, you know, short little punchy scenes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's some of it is dialogue, some of it is narrative. It varies. But I was determined of one thing, and that was that I wasn't going to do any imitations. I wasn't going to do any voices. Mm-hmm. So I represent people's voices, but we do some audio magic. The amazing audio designer that works with me, Jeff Schmidt, did some terrific audio magic to kind of alter my voice in certain ways. It comes from different places, left and right, that kind of thing. So the way it works out is that it sounds like different people talking to each other, even though you recognize it's the same person. So the effect is more like a story told, literally storytelling.
How long does it take to make an episode if you have to do all that going into it?
Boy. Do you really want to know from the beginning?
Yeah, I do, because like I think of podcasts and I'm like, we sit here in a room once a week for 2 hours.
Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go through the whole process.
Oh, Rob's going to go in chronological
order.
While
we're talking about your voice, though, I will say that now I always will think of you, what your voice is William Friedkin's voice.
Yes.
Even though I see William Friedkin do your voice now, the my part where he's sitting out in his garden or whatever, I can't get that out of my head now. It's his voice. So
I am his voice.
You are William Friedkin's voice from here on out. Which is not bad.
Which is probably as close as the show will get to freaking. So we might as well just interview you in character.
You never know. You never know. But no, like where it is, obviously, look, to delve into the making of a classic horror film, there has to be some sort of level of love for this material to begin with. And it seems evident that, you know, your love for these titles in the show. So where did it begin? How did Inside Psycho, because that was the first show, how did that even happen?
Well, I mean, look, back to the very beginning, you know, I was a monster kid, like so many people my age. I was a monster kid. So I grew up loving this stuff. I've always loved this stuff. A while back, my wife and I saw The Big Sick, you know, the movie The Big Sick with Camille and Johnny and Emily.
Yeah.
There's a scene in there where Camille shows Emily Dr. Fibes on like their third date. You remember that?
Yes.
So I got to meet them at an awards thing, and I said to Emily, did he really show you that on your third date? And she said, No, it's on the second date. The second, this is some kind of like monster god. The second date, he's showing Dr. Fibes.
Well,
it's just amazing.
It's technically a love film.
That is pretty romantic.
It is a love story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great.
He loves his wife.
Yeah. And she said to me, she said, well, yeah, he wrote the, Kamel shows Emily Dr. Fibes, and I wrote the following scene, which was Emily asks Kamel why guys always think they can show women a movie and that's okay. I mean, it was a funny interchange. But to answer your question, who's not a fan of Psycho?
Yeah.
Actually, the first movie in the series wasn't going to be Psycho. It was going to be something else that I can't tell you yet because it turns out that's going to be the third in the series.
So there is a third. You know, that was funny. When I announced that you were coming on the show, just say, hey, Mark Ramsey is going to be on. You should listen Inside Psycho, Inside The Exorcist. Literally, everyone's naming what your next show is going to be. I was like,
I know,
he's going to announce this. He's going to announce that. I was like, no announcements. He's just coming on.
No, I'm not going to announce. The truth of the matter is, I mean, it's harder to pick than people think because not all of these movies are created equal. For the most part, we're dealing with true life backstories. We're dealing with movies that have lots of stories around them, and also got to deal with movies where those stories are known. There's got to be some scholarship. You know, I don't interview all these people from scratch. I go to a bunch of different resources. Psycho was one of those movies.
I want to guess. I'm going to say Rosemary's Baby.
But all I'll tell you is that the director is John Borman, and Linda Blair is also in it, and it is a masterwork.
Inside The Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
There
it comes.
There you go.
You're going full Heretic.
Definitely staring clear of sequels for now. That much I can tell you. I mean, everyone said, "Oh, you're going to do Psycho 2."
Yeah. Oh, no, wait. Yeah. I could. I may go Jaws. I'm trying to think. Like what?
Confirm or deny.
But
anything.
So you had a first choice, and for whatever reason that didn't work out, and it became Psycho.
No, it did. It's not that it didn't work out. It's at the time I'm on the board of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, and our show, our annual award show, the Critics' Choice Awards, aired on A&E. A&E was looking for potential content that would work on their digital platform from members of BFCA, my critics group, and A&E had, as you know, a little show called Bates Motel. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, what if I, instead of doing the one I was going to do, you almost got me to say it. I do. Very good.
You're going to keep naming titles so you
can. We can edit it out if you say it accidentally.
So instead of that, I thought, let me do Psycho because I don't think Psycho is a natural first choice. I mean, what is it, 60 years old? I mean, I actually had people say to me, why'd you pick such an old movie? And I said, what part of classic don't you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was why I picked Psycho. And it was interesting because we did the teaser first, which was the first 5 minutes or so. That's all we produced. And we sent it up to the guys at A&E. And before they got it, they said, look, we'll take any kind of content, but here's the thing, anything but audio. No audio. We're not interested in audio. Don't send audio. So, of course, I sent audio, and they got back to us on all the content they got, video, whatever, text, and they said, we didn't really care for anything, but we loved Inside Psycho. So it just goes to show you, nobody knows what they want. They were looking for, I guess, some kind of crappy audio something, and what they got was this. Audio is awful for viral. We all know this. Audio is bad for viral. What they got was this very kind of, you know, vivid, gripping opening to the Ed Gein story, which of course is at the root of Psycho and other movies, and they didn't expect it. So that's how that came to be. And then I took that and I went looking for people who could help me fund it because as it happened, they decided, we don't want to go this route. So I said, okay, who else can fund this? And I knew the guys at Wondery. I had met the guys at Wondery. The guys at Wondery come from a television background. They come from Fox. Mm-hmm. And this just struck me as the kind of thing that required that kind of sensibility, someone who has a television sensibility, a cinematic sensibility, a visual sensibility. It's a very visual experience. And I didn't want a typical public radio refugee, with all due respect to the public radio folks. So the Wondery guys embraced it. They said yes. They said yes, Cole, right off the pilot. And we produced the whole series. We got almost no notes on it. And in fact, for Exorcist, the second round, we got almost literally no notes on the whole thing. So it was really, really a huge amount of creative freedom, a huge amount of support and respect. They know how to get shows high ranking. I mean, both these shows were top 10 on iTunes when they were new.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be happier with that. And they both generate rights. So, you know, there's the potential for other manifestations of these shows across other platforms.
Wow. And, you know, I kind of want to talk about approach, because what's unique about this version of the show, I mean, look, when I did my psycho doc, it's like there's a million documentaries out there. There's a million books out there. There's so much material out there. How do you do something a little bit different? And so in my case, I was always set on the sequels anyway, because I'm like, I can't top what everyone else has already documented sure. about the first movie. So I will, you know, tip hat to it, but then talk about what came after. And so, I mean, what's interesting is your approach is unique for both these shows. I actually like Inside the Exorcist a little bit better than mm-hmm. Inside Psycho, even though that's blasphemy for me, the Psycho fan, to say, because it's a unique approach. It doesn't even follow narrative in a traditional, regular, you know, chronologically. It's like you get all these different stories together and they intersect, and it's like it's a very unique way of retelling this sort of biography of the making of movies. So, you know, with Psycho, where do you start? Like, because there's so much out there, how are you going to make your stamp and make something different that people haven't heard already?
Well, you know, and that's a great question. It's a great analysis of what's and interestingly, some of the way the threads work together are. There's some Easter eggs in there. I mean, my favorite Easter egg that I don't think anybody's commented on yet to me that I know about is that there's a restaurant in which a certain scene happens in Psycho, and it turns out that in Exorcist there's another scene happening at that same restaurant at that same time at another table. And it's interesting, and I don't allude to it, but oh yeah, there's Hitchcock over there. Oh, here's Billy Friedkin over here. And in the third one, guess what? We're going to be back at that restaurant again for something else. So it's kind of a cool.
It's Friedkin wearing a tie.
He never wears a tie.
I know. He didn't.
You should listen to
the show. Don't go there. Don't go there.
The great part.
Definitely don't go there. But the answer to your question is, I knew going in I wanted to create something different. And I knew also this. I mean, my background's in audio, not from production, but from a creative kind of marketing standpoint. And I knew I wanted to create something that was impactful. And with all due respect to the folks at Blumhouse, audio is scarier than video. And we all know you turn down the volume on anything, and it's not nearly as scary as with the volume up. And if you take the pictures away, you create that space for stuff to happen that you can't understand. We did that a lot in both shows, especially, I think, in Exorcist, where there were just moments where Jeff and I would say, let's create a little more silence. And he said to me later, he said, it's hard because, you know, in the broadcast space, dead air is a bad thing, but here we're kind of using dead air emotionally to create certain impacts. And when you're listening for something and you don't hear it, your ear gets closer and you get more anxious. So we use that a lot. So I knew I wanted to create something that was more impactful. And we also knew that I wanted to tell a story that had a lot of different voices, but not a lot of characters. I'm not a believer in radio drama anymore. I don't really feel like that's got a lifeline. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let me use my voice. Let me not pretend to be Alfred Hitchcock. Let me just represent Alfred Hitchcock along with the other voices around him and tell a story that way, using the magic of a great sound designer to kind of weave all this together. And then we did it in a nonlinear way, which is what you were talking about before, how it starts and ends in different places, primarily because that's what television does. Mm.
What's you more know, cinematic than radio drama? Because you get to internal thoughts. So you get to actually speak these things that people are thinking internally. I think that's why it's more poetic. I think that's why it works, to be honest.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. And, you know, we've got – now I've got a couple of ideas backlogged, too. I'm working actually on one project now that's not in the horror category at all, but is built kind of the same way. And then I'll go back to Wondery with another chapter of the Inside franchise later. And then I've got a couple more backlogged after that where I've got some really interesting ideas on how to use audio. Because really, one thing Jeff always tells me is he's aware that I'm trying to write for audio. You know, this is my sound designer partner. And writing for audio takes special effort. You have to rewrite the scenes to kind of say, why does this scene exist? What am I supposed to be hearing in this scene other than dialogue? Why is it worth existing? It's the same thing a screenwriter goes through, I guess, except in this case, instead of saying, you know, visually, where does this fit? You're saying, is there a sound that makes sense here? And so that's one of the reasons why we chose The Exorcist as number two, because the sound palette was just irresistible. You know, the sounds of that real life exorcism. And the other thing about the story, I think, that you indicate that makes it a little bit different is it's, people have said to me, did this happen? Did this really happen? Did these certain things really happen?
I was going to say fact versus fiction.
Fact versus fiction. And I said, look, when you watch a biopic at the movie theater, do you ask, did that really happen? Or do you say, well, it's Leonardo DiCaprio, so it's divorced from reality already, right? I mean, it's okay to tell a story that's not 100% true as long as you are creating the thrust of truth. I mean, true-ish, you know, and that's what it is. Not every second in there is true. You know, the Rob, I mean, and there are clues to that throughout. I mean, the fact that in Exorcist, I call the real life possessed boy Robbie.
Yeah.
That's a pretty well-established pseudonym, but I don't indicate that it's a pseudonym. In fact, I talk to him on the phone as Robbie or Rob. And why in the world would I do that if it's a pseudonym? It would make no sense. So, you know, there are clues throughout about what's true and what isn't. And I drop those in, and it's interesting to see how some people interpret it. And I love getting reactions from people like, I was on the Stairmaster at the very end, and I flew off, and everyone thought I was nuts. I got a note from one guy at the New York Times who said, I was listening to it, I was driving alone on a country road, and I almost drove off the road. I mean, who doesn't love that?
That's great.
Because you're getting the same reaction as a horror film at that point.
You've been responsible for a rash of audio-related accidents.
Audio-related accidents. There's a movie in that.
And there's parts I didn't know. Like, and I felt pretty well-read. I mean, I knew all about Eileen Dietz because I'd met her years ago, so I knew that side of the story. The part I really found most hypnotic in the Exorcist story was about the woman who provided the voice of Pazuzu. That was a fascinating, kind of heartbreaking story. Just the kind of – and also, but also really interesting, her performance process to get into character, how she was this devout Catholic and locks herself away and smokes and drinks. And it's just, to me, that was just fascinating. And the way you portray it is fascinating.
And that was really all true. And the story of her son, which is really tragic, who committed suicide basically at Christmas time. I mean, all of that is told in here. And the thing about this is you can't get all this from any one place. I mean, you ask how much effort went into it, how long it took. I mean, the answer is, you know, you have to have some secondary sources available. You know, I go to a bunch of different books. I gather those together. I go to internet sources, but it takes like 2 to 4 months of research. And then it takes about 6 to 8 weeks of writing. And then it takes another 6 to 8 weeks of recording. That's a long time.
So this is like a full movie production time period here.
You know what? Honestly, that's the way we thought of it. And even if you talk to the guys at Wondery, they'll tell you, yeah, we know that we need to do a lot of like regular weekly shows like this show. We know that that's the way that you build audiences, you grow audiences, you develop advertisers and so on over time. But we also want to keep our hand in events. Just like television with limited series, The Alienist right now, you know? I mean, this is basically Inside Psycho, Inside the Exorcist is basically a limited series.
Yeah.
How many episodes did you do of each?
6 for Psycho and 7 for Exorcist. Okay. And, you know, I try and, like, organically what makes sense. The one I'm working on right now is going to be 6. And I hope the next Inside one, I hope, is also 6. But I think increasingly what I'm interested in these stories is getting beyond just the kind of jump scares to, you know, this, there are some really, really wild stories of these people who are involved in the making of these movies and their personal stories and what it, and, you know, underneath it all is, this is what it takes to create something amazing. Mm-hmm. This is the pain you go through to create something amazing. This is what happens to you after you create something amazing. I mean, a filmmaker friend of mine said to me, you know, you actually have me feeling sorry for Hitchcock. And here's a filmmaker who, by any standard, you know, has achieved as much as anyone can possibly achieve. And here he had me feeling sorry for him. Well, why not? The man never won an Oscar for the quality of his work.
Yeah.
You know, what's not to feel sorry for? He was never able to top Psycho, which was just, as you know, just like, as you know, especially insanely successful. Much more so than any of his other movies, including The Birds.
Yeah. When you have these directors who make a masterpiece that also, like in his case, say your Vertigo and Carpenter, The Thing, these people who make a masterpiece, but at the time of its release, no one likes it and it doesn't do well financially. And that's fascinating to me because that tends to be the decline point after that for that artist. It's very hard to come back from that.
Interesting. It's an interesting to say that, but at the same time, that isn't the Psycho story, nor is it the Exorcist story. those were both kind of the opposite.
Oh, yeah. They're both
I haven't really hit yet one of the downturns. The thing situations. That would be an interesting direction to go. Someone who, you know, is kind of redeemed over time as opposed to in the kind of the It's a Wonderful Life effect. You know, something becomes a classic later, but in its time, it's diminished.
Yeah, which as we know from the times when carpenters ask about that, you realize, artists don't really like that. They don't really care that 20 years, it's not as exciting for them that 20 years later is discovered.
They want it when it comes out. They want the money then.
Yeah.
Well, isn't there a funny story with him having a conversation with Guillermo del Toro? And del Toro is telling him, you made the thing, it is a classic now. And he's like, yeah, but what good does it do with me now?
Yeah.
Like, I need it to be, a classic at the time, when it came out.
Well, you know, but look at Guillermo. I mean, that's a good example. I mean, his table was about three tables over from me at the Critics' Choice Awards. And I thought about him there. He made this movie for next to nothing, Shape of Water, right? This dream project for him. I mean, if anybody can get a movie made at whatever price they want to get it made for, you would think it would be Guillermo del Toro, right? He couldn't get that movie made at anything but a budget, a Blumhouse-style price. And look at the outcome. I mean, I will be surprised if that's not the best picture of the year at the Oscars.
Well, it's up against another Blumhouse style price one. Get out.
That's true.
But it is true that many of the films that you see nominated for Oscars were forced to be made on a budget because somebody was, you know, it's a risky venture. And it's either going to turn out to be brilliant or it's going to turn out to be bad. And so people are scared to take the risk.
Maybe you'll get Lovecraft movie made. That'd be nice.
But how different would Psycho have been had it not have those limitations, you know?
Had he not made it independently.
Yeah. Or with his TV crew. And it's like if he had had everything, all the resources, You know, I remember hearing the story, Drag Me to Hell just came out on Blu-ray from Scream Factory, and Sam Raimi had said, he did three Spider-Man movies back to back, and he's on set saying, let's get the dolly and this and that. And we don't have that on this movie. And he's like, and he said he was happy because it made him rethink the way he used to think. You know, when you're on these big, Spider-Man movies or whatever, and anything you want, anything from, equipment to if you need your shirt pressed to whatever you need done on a whim, and then getting kind of stripping that back and then rethinking this is great, this is going to be fun because we're going to do it this way,
the way he used to do it.
I think that ended up making some of the most kind of memorable scenes from Psycho. For instance, the scene where what is his name, the inspector, Arbogast, where he's falling backwards down the stairs, and it's you can tell he's on like a chair, and the reverse screen behind him, whatever it is, it's really disorienting. And I know that it was done cheaply and simply, but whatever they did, it felt more disorienting the way that they did it on a budget than if he had actually been able to throw him down the stairs.
Well, that's so true. And I was very cognizant of that with these shows, because you can tell not a lot of resources go into them in terms of people. I mean, it's after all, I could have had a cast of a dozen. You know, I could, especially Exorcist was pretty epic. There were like dozens of quote-unquote speaking roles in that. And this notion that, and they asked me when I first came to Wondery with Psycho, they said, so don't you want like a second voice at least? and I said, no, but that constraint, the constraint of saying, I want to do this just with my voice is an established constraint. And then you ask the question, well, how can I do it just with that? And if you study, the history of movies, not just horror movies, but go back to Orson Welles. I mean, he made most of the movies, if not all of the movies in his later career on a shoestring. He would make movies just to make money. He would be in movies just to make money so he could make movies for next to nothing. And people would die during the making of his movies, and they'd have to be recast with other people as stand-ins. It was that bad.
And he only got to make movies because of his audio work. It's his audio work that broke him into the industry.
Right. So, that's right.
Yeah. And a similar kind of thing in a way. I mean, that was obviously more of a straight gag radio drama, almost a practical joke gone awry, but a similar kind of thing in terms of kind of pulling in an audience and feeling alive. You know?
That's true. And I think that, even now, I think one of the reasons why I do this podcast stuff at all is because all of a sudden, look at, podcasts are being sold into film and television all of a sudden. That's a new thing. Well, this is as good a source for intellectual property as anything else. If you can make great content here, it's like making a great play, a great comic, a great book. It's the same thing. And I think only now is that being fully realized.
You know, I think the thing that fascinates us about these kind of shows, but in particular, making ofs. I will break out my Exorcist box set or Psycho occasionally, and instead of watching the movie, I'm like, you know what? I want to watch the 90-minute documentary on the making of Psycho that's on here that Laurent did because it's terrific. Or like now there's like, I think, two or three feature-length ones on Exorcist. You know, maybe you could answer this too, but what is it in us that we're obsessed with the making of these films? I mean, is it specifically horror films, like horror classics and everything that goes into it? Or Elric, I assume for you it's all film, but I think I'm more obsessive over horror.
Probably because there's more elements going on. Like a straight drama, I don't know if you really, you know, unless it's dramatic, what happened behind the scenes, who cares?
I always look at horror as like there's formulas that go into it and there's things that you do, and you talked about the music or the audio angle. There's things that are done in horror to achieve the fear. And it's not just something jumps out at you. There's a lot of different things that work with audio and lighting and effects and acting and the way that the camera is placed. And I think that those things, at least for me, are more fascinating to learn about the behind the scenes of how the craft goes into sculpting the fear, as opposed to just, you know, a drama and finding out, you know, why the director had full lighting and things like that.
Well, let me veer off to the left a little bit for you on this, because for what my intention was, and this is, I think, one of the challenges with something called Inside ... you know, Inside Psycho, Inside Exorcist, is sometimes people assume that it's a making of documentary audio style. And those who listen to it, you guys have heard them and you know that they're clearly not that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't want people who, if you want to see the making of documentary for Psycho or Exorcist, go watch it.
Yeah.
As we all know, there are good ones out there, right? This is not that. This is, in fact, in the case of Psycho, as the story goes, you realize that it's a story of a guy who was really successful, who bet everything he had on one thing that he thought would work, right? He bet it all on this one thing. It was successful beyond his wildest dreams, and then he could never match it. That's the story. It's the story of the person who succeeds beyond their wildest dreams and then can't figure out what to do next. That's a human story. Yeah. That's a story about entrepreneurs. That's a story about people who make things. That's a story about any of us. That's what I was trying. That's an artist's story.
Yeah.
And then in Exorcist, I was going a little bit different. It was more because in Exorcist case, it was, you know, Friedkin had this huge success as a very young man. And, you know, here Exorcist was just this massive hit. And he was still so young and he was A-list. He was number one on the A-list. Anything he touched turned to gold, or at least so he thought. And it was that kind of arrogance that led him to his downfall.
And his best film.
Well,
I, as a Sorcerer fan, I believe Sorcerer is one of the best American movies ever made, and yet it was completely his downfall because his ego was rampant on it.
Not only that, but as I said in the show, you know, it came out a month after this other little movie called Star Wars, which he overlooked. He poo-pooed and overlooked, and he kind of missed that turn in the audience, which is important too. You got to know where the audience is turning. I think a lot of the success that Blumhouse is having right now is because it has its finger on where the audience is and is going. And that's an important thing. But in the case of Exorcist, that's really a story about this guy who had this incredible success young, thought he could walk on water, and then realized he couldn't and had to come to terms with the fact that this was it. And for the rest of his life, and finally, and it's, you know, it comes down, it's coalesced in a story I tell towards the end when he's on the hillside in LA with his wife, where I basically, the lesson there is, you know, you don't always get what you want, but you always get what's yours, and you need to come to terms and appreciate that. And I thought in both these cases, those are two strong lessons, two completely different lessons that are almost snuck in there in the context of a story about an exorcism and a horror movie and a mass murderer and a cheaply made film at the Universal Studios that everyone wanted to bury.
Yeah, it's the human moment of your stories that I think is what sets them apart from just being, a good horror story. No, it absolutely is. Now, I'm not going to put you on the spot, and you don't have to respond. But
he's totally going to put you on the spot right
so
now.
You might have to, because if I get this right, you know, don't read into this audience. But I have this idea for you. There is a connection, because thinking about, we like these shared worlds, and it was a Q&A that we were at that's bringing this to my mind. Because you start with Hitchcock, and Hitchcock led you to Friedkin, there's interaction between these two characters in the Friedkin American one, I think there'd be a beautiful story that might not be widely put out there, but we saw it in a Q&A between if you were going to do a certain movie at some point by a certain director called Toby Hooper. And the reason I suggest this is because Friedkin told the most magnificent, beautiful story on stage with Toby Hooper, where he basically told us how he was the first, basically no one had seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre outside of Texas, had no life here. He saw it at one screening, and it was like it lit his brain on fire, and he literally contacted this guy, tried to find this guy in Texas, bring him out, and he took it personally. Friedkin personally took the print to every single studio and screened it for everyone himself because he was so enamored by this movie. And just watching him on stage with a very quiet Toby Hooper going, yeah, that happened, it was freaking...
It's pretty magical. It was one of my favorite... Are you familiar with this whole backstory between the two?
And something I had never heard.
Not between the two, no, I didn't.
Oh, my God. Well,
we had never heard that before.
It was the 40th anniversary of Texas Chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And Friedkin was hosting the Q&A.
And he's a hell of a...
And he's a great storyteller.
Yeah,
Elric and I were sitting there kind of in awe because we'd never heard this before. Like, Toby said he went into like a 7-Eleven, and on the front of the newspaper was like Friedkin coming out of a movie theater with Dino De Laurentiis.
Yeah.
Coming out of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like a photo of them on the front. And basically, Friedkin just showed everyone that would listen this movie. He's like, have you seen this movie? You have to see this movie.
Else, yeah.
Like, we have to find this filmmaker. And apparently kind of took him under his wing. And
Hooper really kind of more or less said that's the reason it was successful.
Yeah.
It's because of that initial thing that Friedkin gave me. And so anyway, even if whether it is, there's going
to
be no answer. I don't want
to make
you,
a note of that.
But I'll tell you, if you ever go there, I'd love to see a third crossover because all these three people, you know, it's fun.
Plus, one thing I'll tell you. Such a personality to begin with. I mean, I just remember Rob's story about him ordering coffee at one point. And even just that's a story.
Who ordered coffee? Friedkin?
I took him to a commentary once.
This is Hooper.
He showed up.
Hooper.
Yeah. And he's like, can I have coffee? And they're like, how do you take it? He's like, strong.
Just one word, but it's great.
That's a short story.
That's how he was.
Sometimes the shortest stories are the best stories. Now I appreciate that that story, and I guess the challenge with...
I appreciate your pitch, Elric. Way to go.
I'm still gunning for Jaws here, guys.
The reason why that's more of a challenge, that particular movie, is because the origin story is the same as the Psycho origin story.
You're right. Yeah.
It really kind of calls for a different stylistic approach, which is possible. I mean, like I say, the project I'm doing now, which Rob knows about, is not a horror project at all, and it doesn't have a horror origin story. So, you know, I found my way around that. But one great thing about doing these projects is that I like the idea that they can evolve.
You know,
and I think the next one is going to be a little bit different, a little less horrible than the last two. Because, you know, as I said to, Jeff Schmidt, my production designer, and I said, can we do a better job of scaring people than we did? You know, can we do on a third one? Can we scare people more effectively on a third one than we did in the second? I think we've really kind of reached the apex of that.
It'll be hard to do on Ghost of Mars. I mean, it's good that you're going there, and I appreciate, because there are fans, don't get me wrong, but good luck, man.
I'll tell you, part of me, I mean, it's not going to be...
Let's hear your Ice Cube voice.
It's not going to be... Oh, there you go. It sounds just like this voice. Yeah. It's not going to be Halloween, but part of me would like, but would looks forward to eventually doing Halloween, you know, I'm one of the lucky people who got to be in the theater on day one. And I will
tell us,
never
spill. I like these stories.
I will never forget.
Stories.
Well, I mean, I went with a bunch of kids from school, and so it was a group, and it was a full place. And you know, these were in the days when you didn't know everything about every movie, and movies would kind of crawl into Cineplexes and cinema, and you know, they you'd hear a little bit of hubbub, but that was it. And nobody. There were no spoilers, right?
Yeah.
No spoilers. And the idea of anything being killed and coming back to life, that didn't happen.
Ever.
So I just remember that when stuff happened in that movie, just looking around the theater and people were just falling over themselves. They were screaming. Yeah. They were laughing. They were falling. They were just panicking. It was just an emotional release that I've never seen before.
Yeah,
you almost have to go to like the commercials for Paranormal Activity to see anything close to that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's audio on YouTube from a Halloween screening.
Really?
From a vintage Halloween screening, and it's great because you can tell. I think they edited it to the scene, even though obviously they were bootlegging or whatever. And just the gasps and everyone like reacting to, you know, Michael Myers just standing straight up again.
Yeah, it's you. I mean, to look at it now, to see it on TV or see it on DVD or whatever, or to see the sequels, you can't ever put that genie back in the bottle. This is what's so hard. This is why it's going to be so hard to bring the new one back because it's got to come back as something else. You know, it's like Pet Sematary. Yeah. It's got to come back different because you can't ever return it to what it was.
Yeah. And with Halloween, it's just, I mean, my older brother saw it in theaters and he told me, he's like, I couldn't sleep. I had left the lights on. It was like that because you had never seen anything where a killer would just keep getting back up and coming. Like, you know, our monsters are human or they were actual monsters.
And especially before they became pop icons. Like, that's what I always say about Nightmare on Elm Street. If that had just been a one-off movie and we had just been in the consciousness, it'd be so frightening if you'd kept that Freddy.
Scared,
I mean, and then of course it becomes a comic character and it's fun and everything, but those first waves of those two characters are just so scary.
I teach at USC and I'd asked my students right when the new Chucky film came out, I asked them if any of them, you know, were going to see it and everything, and we were talking about it, and most of them don't find Chucky scary.
That
first movie.
The first movie is scary. Terrifying, but then after that, when you get into like Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky, he loses his edge, and then so he just, and that was kind of the ones that they remembered, is they remember Bride of Chucky more than they do the original one. And so just because of
they're
the longevity,
born after the Matrix.
But this is the hard part, because edges are made to be lost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why it's an edge. And that's what makes all this so hard. I don't think I saw Chainsaw, the original Chainsaw, for years until after I had seen a couple of sequels on television or something. All of a sudden I saw the original. I was like, wow.
That's not what you were
doing. This is really good. I mean, how did that generate these other things that I saw? I didn't expect anything near this good. So it's really, and I think that's, again, another reason why doing these shows that I've done is an attempt to create something, in a sense, new to the world.
Yeah.
Because if you don't create eventually something new to the world, all you get are sequels.
Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of sequels, since you didn't get to touch upon them on either of your shows, I would like to know your thoughts on the Psycho sequels and the Exorcist sequels.
You know what? The truth of the matter is, it's some of the Exorcist sequels, I don't know, except the really recent ones, I don't even know if I've seen. It's been so long.
Oh, you've seen part three.
Three is the only one that counts.
I think I've probably seen part three.
Yeah.
Three is a fun movie.
Richard Burton was in one, right?
Not that one.
That's one. You don't need to see that one.
It was in part two.
I go back and forth arguing which one scared me more, the original Exorcist or part three. Because part three is really terrifying.
I've heard that. Heard that.
It's worth watching.
But the difference is it's a really fun movie, but you're always aware you're watching a movie. It's entertaining in that way that a movie is. And I think the success of part one is that it blurs those boundaries and feels documental, and because that was Friedkin style. So they're very different, I think. Like, it's much easier to lose yourself in Exorcists, maybe not now, but at the time.
I talked about this on Killer POV. I think we did our show where we talked about classics that we don't find as terrific as, and I think The Exorcist is terrific, but for me, it never affected me when I was a kid because I wasn't raised in a religious household. So this whole kind of like possession devil stuff, I was very much like, psh! Like, it just didn't affect me.
Isn't that the big John Landis joke? Like, he's the one person that wasn't scared because he was Jewish boy.
It's true, though. Like, going into it, it's the same reason that I was always amused by nun films and still am. I was never raised in that environment. So, like, looking at nuns in movies, I was like, so they can fight devil, they sing, and they can fly. And that's, like, what I absorbed about nuns. And so seeing religion from kind of a non-religious background, The Exorcist didn't scare me as much as a kid, nearly as much as something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre did.
As you know, the people who did Exorcist are fond of saying that it's an intensely spiritual film. And the tongues are not in cheek when they say that. And in fact, you know, I mean, I grew up Catholic. I was an altar boy. So, I mean, this has been, you know, in fact, one of the Jesuit priests that was an advisor to Exorcist taught my brother in Rochester at the college he went to, at the Catholic college he went to. So this is in my background. Mm-hmm. I recognized all this stuff, but I thought it would be interesting if, like the movie, this series could have a spiritual component to it. And it actually did, I think, or at mm-hmm. least I built it in. I don't know if it was received that way, but that was my intention. It was interesting to hear from some people who said, yeah, ZipRecruiter doesn't want to advertise in that because it's got a religious element, you know, an exorcism. It's just too controversial. And I thought, too controversial? Psycho had said, you know, a bunch of people being made into lawn furniture.
Right.
And this is just the struggle of good versus evil in the world today. I mean, true crime is the biggest category there is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you'll advertise on everything Ryan Murphy does on Fox, but you won't advertise. It doesn't make any sense.
But Shudder had no problem advertising.
We love ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, you're fantastic people. Thank you for
your
ads.
That. I didn't know ZipRecruiter was on.
Okay.
It's
all right. They're not on this episode.
Yeah, they're not on this episode, so I think we're clear.
Did you know that if you put an ad on ZipRecruiter, you're going to get a qualified candidate within 24 hours?
We do now.
The number one leading source of ads.
I just heard that.
And that's actually, ZipRecruiter is actually responsible for Gus Van Sant's remake of Psycho. A lot of people don't know that. They actually cast the film through ZipRecruiter.
Yes, that's why.
That's how they get Vince Vaughn and Hayes perfectly cast.
If we say the name incredible. Enough, maybe I can get them to sponsor this episode.
I do want to say about Shudder. I mean, you mentioned Shudder. I know they're an advertiser too, but they did something really cool as part of their advertising on Inside Exorcist. They actually had the podcast on Shudder. So
that's cool.
I heard from a lot of people who discovered the podcast because they found it on Shudder over the top.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So it's great. And I think that's more proof that, you know, when you think of these things as bigger than just what they start as, when you realize that, you know, of course Shudder should have something like that on its platform. Who cares that it's just audio, no video? They should have more stuff like that. And, you know, it should be on other, it builds this thing into a bigger animal than it began as. And that's how franchises happen. And ultimately, you know, if we create anything, any of us who create anything, want to see people embrace it.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice timeless quality to that your show, too. Like, even though you've already done well with it, it's nice to know that 5 years from now, it's not going to change at all. And people discovering it 5 years will enjoy it in exactly the same way.
Because
they're about classic movies and they're classically made. And, you know, what we do is a little less evergreen, I feel, because it's a weekly show and there's news or things like that that instantly, you know, dated a bit, but not the interviews. That's the nice part, you know. So knowing what you do last, and I hate this idea of content creators. It kind of that even that term about modern media makes me a little sick because it makes it sound like we're just creating something to stick somewhere for someone to get. It's
you're
more than
to interrupt
that.
Somebody.
Yeah, no, it's much more than that. You're trying to create something that will stick around and is of interest and will educate and move.
You guys
people.
Go to all these conferences. You guys go to all these conventions. You know, I mean, aren't those places littered with folks?
Oh yeah,
exactly that.
Into
I mean,
it, yeah.
That's the dream. That's again why I did these shows, because if you think about what Friedkin's going through, if you think about what Hitchcock's going through, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what do you consider, you don't have to narrow it down to one, but what's the one piece of research material out there for each film that you think is kind of essential for fans? And, you know, as an example, I mean, I could do a dozen Psycho ones, but, you know, Stephen Rebella's book, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, is kind of the epitome of making a book. Were there any that you discovered in the process for either film that surprised you? I haven't read Friedkin's bio, for example, yet, but I hear it's great.
Yeah.
Well, in the Psycho case, the Rebella book was one of the main sources. I can't remember the author, but one of the Hitchcock biographies was another main source, and then zillions of various internet sources for a lot of things. The interesting thing about the Rebella book is that, as we all know, it was made into a movie.
Yeah.
With Anthony Hopkins. And talk about something that is, you know, diverts from reality to
taking
some degree.
Liberties. he'll be the first to admit that, as he did on our show.
I'm sure he would. And so that was certainly a prime source. He obviously did a lot of legwork there, and there was a lot of duplication between that and in the biography I read. In the case of Exorcist, the Friedkin book was good, and he was wise enough to focus the book on the movies that he knew people would be most interested mm-hmm. in, namely French Connection and Exorcist. Yeah. But I had to really look a lot deeper because there is no contemporary insider's look at the Exorcist that's in print right now. Hmm. There just isn't. Hmm. I found a book that was written by Peter
Cowie?
Travers.
Oh, Travers, yeah.
Peter Travers, then from Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
Back in 1974.
Oh.
And that was really useful. So that's, you know, you have to get it through eBay. So it's the yellowed pages, you know, it's just, it's fascinating. But it also, I think, is interesting to me to be able to go to a source that you know is long out of print and bring new life to that. And maybe, in a sense, make it worthwhile checking out for people today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember there's one Psycho book that I kind of, because I read all of them. I really liked, Janet Leigh did one that I thought was pretty good, Psycho Behind the Scenes of a Classic Thriller, which is basically she kind of co-wrote with somebody her perspective of making the movie Psycho, which, again, everybody has a different perspective when it comes to what's a classic.
Now, I did also in the case of, I didn't do any interviews for Exorcist for Psycho. I talked to Paul Jasman.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah.
Paul Jasman, for anybody who doesn't know, is one of the three. I presented him as the one person, but in fact, there were three people, right, who were the voice of Tony Perkins' mother in the movie.
In the original. Is it three or four?
It might be four.
Yeah.
Three or four, I forget. But it depends on how you want to define four.
Right.
But he was, I guess, the one at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And he was more at the beginning than at the end, mm-hmm. the beginning of the process than the end of the process. And he's a famed fashion photographer living in LA now. And so I called him up. He agreed to do an interview. So it was fun. He talked about just it's interesting. And you know this, Rob, because you did the documentary, but talking with people who were there then, there's something about that which is just sublime. Because these people were there, these people touched those people, these people were on the scene, these people were part of these amazing things that you're talking to them about. You almost have to pinch yourself, you know, when you're talking to these folks, because it's, I can't believe I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
And you were the guy who was at the parties with Tony Perkins, you know, joke calling starlets that were on Tony's... Tony's black book, and calling them as this old woman, and Tony's recorded all of them, and Tony's laughing, and you're laughing, and everybody at the party's laughing, and you play it for Hitchcock. Hitchcock thinks it's funny, but it's more than that, because he said, this voice is very interesting. This would be great as the voice of Tony Perkins' mother.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just one of those little details that's kind of cool. And to know that guy, you know, went on to a fabulous photography career, and, you know, couldn't tell me some of the... I asked him some of the things he wouldn't tell me and couldn't tell me about their carousing days in New York and L.A. He wouldn't get into that. He said, oh, Osgood is Oz, and what's Oz's brother?
Elvis.
Oz and Elvis, they're very close to me. I can't tell you any details.
Yeah.
I said, okay.
I just like, what I like about that is that no one's ever worked on a, like you're up to these people who you're talking about, and no one's ever worked on a masterpiece, and people have only ever worked on films. But in hindsight, they're masterpieces. So anyone working on it is like the sound recorder said, which Ted Nicolai or whatever from Texas Chainsaw Massacre went on to be a director. You think about it and you're like, oh yeah, he's just recording sound on a film, which is a pain in the ass on any movie. So whatever his experience, it's not exceptional or extraordinary. And yet to anyone after the fact, it is extraordinary because the film is it's transformed. Once it's done, once it's on a screen, it's a different experience. So I do find that fascinating that we look back as, oh, it must be the most amazing thing. And to some people, it's like, oh, it's just on a movie. Some sets are better and more exciting than others, or electric, but it's still movie making.
And I see that play out even in these little podcast series, because you know you have the idea, you write it down, it seems like it's good, you narrate it, you can't possibly tell, and then it comes back, the audio production's in, you got a couple of tweaks, but otherwise you listen to it, and especially on Exorcist, where Jeff really went beyond the call in creating, you know, an audio tapestry that I mean, honest to God, if you put headphones on and you listen to that series, I think you will conclude you've never heard anything that potent before. I mean, some of it is just unbelievable. He was buying like wood crates and stuff to make some of the practical sound effects. It was just an amazing process that he went through to do this. And you can't pay someone enough to do this well. They have to do it that well because they love it.
Shh, Ernie's listening. You can pay them just enough to keep them awake and not yawn when they talk to Carpenter.
Oh, don't give him shit.
That one again.
Love Ernie.
Have you seen the Exorcist TV series, the two seasons?
And what'd you think?
I wish they had shouted out the podcast. I'll tell you that. they did not, as far as I could tell. The minute it started, I thought, well, where's this going to go? And I thought, and then in the second season was you know, had some relevance I won't go into. Those of you who've seen it know from the movie.
We've talked about how it ties in with the film.
The second season, I thought,
where the heck is this going to go? And then once you get beyond the obvious twist, it's like, well, this is, I said, why so many kids was my first thought, you know, because look, this was in the podcast series for Exorcist, you know, when you put so much weight on the shoulders of a 12-year-old girl, you're playing with fire. Yeah. And when you have a house full of, you know, teenagers, which is what that movie had, in what I would consider a crass attempt to deal with the 18 to 49 demo, then you better do a good job.
Yeah, okay.
I thought the leads were great.
Yeah, the lead of that one.
Those were good kids.
She's from Deadpool. Teenage Nuclear Warhead. Yeah, yeah. That girl. She's phenomenal in it.
Yeah.
So I really liked her.
I hope more people discover, because I actually do love the show. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where I think there's been enough of the bad sequels and stuff where, you know, I feel the same way about Bates Motel. Enough time has gone by that I think we're at a point where we can get reinterpretations or new versions of these stories that can be just as good without crapping on or just completely redoing the original again.
I'd like a couple more versions of Paul Schrader's Exorcist. I just feel like two both dull movies.
Yeah, there's
the same.
How did they
make two bad movies? How is that even possible?
And they're so similarly dull. It's bizarre. It's like, how could these two directors, who are totally different directors, come up with both those dull movies?
Have you ever watched them back to back? It's really fascinating.
I'd kill myself.
It's like taking, you know, like the Thai challenge or something, so where you do it and then it's
like having the same boring nightmare twice in a row.
It is, but you notice.
Let me do this again.
You learn from it because you notice how it's literally kind of the same story, but how they approached it differently. Yeah. But neither of them turned out well, and then they actually use the same footage in parts.
Yeah.
So there's a lesson in there.
How could Father Marin's backstory be that boring?
Yeah. especially with Stellan Skarsgård. I mean, that's perfect casting. No. Like, I want to watch that guy. You know?
Dead Hyena Baby was kind of cool in one of them. I don't remember which one had.
I think that's the Rennie Harlan one.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is, you know, when you're taking a movie that's that iconic and you're saying, well, let's do a series that is related, that's kin to that movie. I mean, you got all these episodes you got to fill. It's got to be dramatically different. I mean, it so in a sense, the comparison is unfair, but in another sense, the comparison is exactly why it got greenlit. Mm. So, you know, what do you do? I mean, if they had called that series not The Exorcist, but something else, I wonder if the interpretation, if, you know, my fairly harsh interpretation might have been different.
Yeah.
Like demons or something. Yeah, if it was just like that. What about contemporary horror? Because, you know, we meet a lot of people who are obsessed, or their roots are in these classic movies we're talking about, and then maybe it wanes, maybe it stays strong. But with movies like The Witch and, you know, things that are genuinely quite scary being made still, have there been certain films that still keep you excited about the genre?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's great being in Blumhouse Central to talk about this stuff, because so many of the most wonderful horror movies, including Get Out of the 21st century, you know, have passed through these walls to some degree. And the idea that those things can get made today, you know, is because you guys know there's moments when horror movies are just on the outs.
You mean social justice thrillers.
There you go.
Let's get it right. That's what we make here, social justice thrillers.
Of course.
For the Oscars.
But I think so many of those movies are really, really of a high caliber in that they do what they aim to do, and they do it really well. Right. And it's invested with effort and in some quality. Yeah. And because, you know, look, I'm on the critics group, Critics Choice, and I would love to lobby for a horror category.
Yeah.
But there's not, you know, they'll look at me and say, well, so many horror movies are crappy.
God, that hurts. I mean, like, there's just as many shitty comedies and shitty dramas.
I don't know if there's a comedy category either, actually, although maybe there is. I don't know.
I can totally
see, I don't
argue.
Want it accepted. I still want it to be a little fringe and punk. Because, I mean, I would like to see Get Out win Best Picture for that feeling of, we trumped it every 40 years. But there's something about it that I do like, that it's always been on the periphery of where it's somewhere between experimental and art house movies, where it's still pushing edges, like we've been talking about, the edges of what is even appropriate. And
one of the modern-ish, I guess, if 10 years old is modern, movies that, you know, it doesn't really squarely fit the category, but always makes a big impact on me and people tend to overlook, is The Prestige.
Oh, yeah.
Christopher Nolan's
very clever
The Prestige.
Film. I really like it. Yeah.
Which, you know, is kind of in the category, but it's bigger than the category. It's got these amazing twists. It's got some name brand talent. It's got Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that's one of those movies I look at and I say, this is a movie that is going to be a classic that was largely overlooked in its time in that category we were talking about before.
Yeah. Are there any other horror titles that you have seen just in the last couple of years, specific ones that keep you going, oh yeah, I'd love to see what that person does now? Like for me, I like The Witch a lot. I don't know if I loved it, but I really liked it. But what it did for me is more like whatever that person makes next, I would need to see it. I'm interested in where that talent goes next and what they do. Is there anything like that?
I think The Witch is in that category.
Oh, yeah.
And Eggers. It was a little moody and stuff. Like that it's a little... You know, but the slowness of it, it struck me, is intentional to kind of let the tension build. Yeah. Plus, I've got these two amazing big black Newfoundlands, and the more rambunctious one we now refer to as Black Phillip.
Oh, so it's
perfect. And of course, Get Out. I mean, nowadays with anything Jordan Peele puts his hands on, now that he's going to redo Twilight Zone and all that, I mean, I find that to be really... I mean, who doesn't look forward to...
Yeah, that's...
But by the way, if you say just Twilight Zone reboot, you know, thumbs down.
Yeah.
But if you say Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone reboot, all of a sudden now I'm interested.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
No, that's true. Are there any audio things, any sort of audio storytelling that you are a fan of these days, or that you... Obviously, it's very near and dear to you, and people are trying different things with it. You know, for example, I love Larry Fessenden, and they've been... doing Tales from Beyond the Pale since before podcast was a thing.
Yep.
Like I even remember trying to figure out, how do we get this out to people? And so people are doing interesting things, but as someone that's in that field, what kind of turns you on in the audio space?
I love Tales. Tales is a great example. I wish they would take the archive content and put it out as podcasts. It would help them promote the new content. And I had Glenn, right?
Yeah.
At an event, his co-producer, creator, at an event that I did to talk about Tales, because I thought it was a great illustration of the form. And it is so ambitious. And they're not getting the credit they deserve because, you know, when you got to buy something, it creates that barrier. Whereas when it's just free and in your way, I mean, that's how radio was built. That's how these things are built.
Yeah.
That's how my podcast is built.
And because they have to realize there's other ways to financially make money on things. Even when it seems like you're giving it away, there are still ways to make money in the long
run. It turns out there are only other ways.
Yeah. No, I mean, as soon as you charge, it's over.
It's like that. But that's the thing. That's why rights have value. I mean, one of the other podcasts on the platform with me, Dirty John, over at Wondery, just sold two seasons of a scripted series based on the story to Bravo, and another season that does unscripted, going into the backstory of the killer guy on Oxygen, their sister network. So that's three seasons of television springing from one podcast that's six episodes long.
Wow.
I mean, that's the power that this can have.
Is that called transmedia? It's this idea about cross-platforming or whatever the hell it's called now.
Now it's called just trying to make a buck.
Interpolation. Yeah. Fancy media term. But that
is that
means,
what they say at USC?
No, it's more of, it is an academic term. I don't think USC uses that, but
I think they haven't settled on a term for that. And transmedia went away when transgender, you know, kind of confuses that term.
I think transmedia got stuck in that whole, we're going to build all these little puzzles and put them in the corners of the internet. And people said, why are you making me go through all that work? Just give me a TV show. Give me a podcast. Give me something.
Interpolation for a while was one of the academic terms for like when a TV comes from a comic book that then becomes a movie and a video game, and so it's interpolated throughout multiple media. So
what I've found really interesting is that the hunger for this kind of content, that's this kind of that because we are in peak media, you know, peak television, there's so much hunger for kind of fresh and original content that captures people's attention, that people are just open to ideas from all kinds of places and all kinds of people. And now, thanks to podcasting, you've got this whole ocean of people who are content creators, sorry for the term, who make stuff that's good.
Yeah, yeah, good.
And now there are new avenues for them to bring those things to life. Because, you know, ultimately, who knows whether any of these projects are going to be successful, whether people will hear them, whether they'll make money. You can't predict any of that. All you know is... I have passion for the idea. I want to make it, and I want it to be good, and I want to put it out there, and some group out there will enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's all you can know.
Well, speaking of Tales Before, I'd listened to your behind-the-scenes bonus episode with you and Jeff, the sound designer on it, and you guys hinted at potentially the desire to do a live one of these. I have to say, as someone that sat in on Tales from Beyond the Pale live, incredible experience.
I'll bet it was.
I loved it. And I think maybe that's the way they make money, sell tickets to the live event.
Oh, it is.
And then put that out, which I think they, the entire last season was, I think, all live episodes. But yeah, there's just something special about sitting in a room with people, closing your eyes while they're doing their thing in front of you. And so I encourage you guys to do live things. Have you thought about that at all? Doing a live version of your show?
You know, we really haven't. And I think it's because we're so busy churning forward. You know, we're going forward with the next project. I mean, these things, because they take so long. And if I go and do a side project for somebody else and come back to Wondery for Inside, well, you know, literally you can't write more, you can't do more than two of these a year. So, I mean, and people burn through these so quick.
Yeah.
It's just like television.
1 week of my driving was all of it, back to back without stopping.
Well, one interesting thing is, you know, they put it out one a week for 6 or 7 weeks. And I think there's a good chance that next time they'll put them out one a day. Which means you'll burn through it that much quicker. But I think that we're in that kind of binging mode now where people just want what they want right away. And if they're into it, they want to keep going.
Yeah.
And if they're not into it, they're going to stop anyway.
Yeah.
That's really true.
It's like a page turner. I think that's what they feel like. I don't want to wait for when I get to the end. Some things aren't bingy, you know?
See, now I have restraint. Even though they're all available, I like to take my time now because I miss. I think Twin Peaks did that to me, you know, the being forced.
But that worked that way. And I feel like Black Mirror works the way you talk about, where it's like 1 week. Watching them back to back, you don't need it. But yours is short, and it's you want to get to the next part. I found it very
easy. Black Mirror's anthology.
Yeah.
So they're disconnected.
Yeah, exactly. It's just thematic.
So. Plus, it's heavy, and you can't watch them back to back, or you feel homicidal or suicidal or just sidle a lot.
There is some heaviness to that.
Yeah, I can't. I can watch one, and then I have to have like a couple weeks breathing room before I can tackle another one.
Stranger Things would be a better metaphor, maybe.
I could watch those all day long, back to back.
I did. I spread them one a day and enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, but you had to be disciplined, right?
I did. I forced myself one a day. I loved it.
I can't do that. Like,
see, I look at that, and I just as you know, someone who's creating stuff, and I say, wow, you know, that, you know, look at what they did. They mixed all these elements. They had some fresh stuff to it. No one's going to be able to duplicate what they did in the same way they did it. Mm. They're going to have trouble duplicating what they did, although they did it for season two quite well.
Yeah.
I'll watch anything Winona Ryder's in.
Yeah. See, I now wait to binge things. Like even some of the shows, even some of the non-horror stuff that I watch, like the Magician show on Sci-Fi, or I'm really excited about The Alienist. I'm not starting them yet. I want to wait till I can watch four episodes back to back. I want to binge it just because I find that to be much more enjoyable than having to wait the week in between.
Yeah.
So I want to wait till the shows wind down. Like even with Channel Zero, I love the binging element that I was able to do. And I could do it last season because they literally sent a screener with all the episodes on it. Mm-hmm. And I watched them all in 2 days. And it was awesome. And I was so excited about it. So I want to wait and do that this round as well.
What do you guys think about The Alienist?
It looks awesome.
I've yet to watch it. I'm looking forward to it.
I haven't seen it yet, but no, we had our guests from a few weeks ago. We're really talking very highly of it. So
I've been really into a lot of the kind of murder mysteries that they've been doing. Like the guys know, I watched the British series Sherlock, and I'd been watching Holmes or Elementary, the US version. And there's one that I watch on Netflix, which I can't remember the name of, but it's set in the 1920s. And I can't remember the name, but it's a female detective in the 1920s. It's kind of like Great Gatsby with murder mysteries and a female detective. And so I've really been enjoying some of these murder mysteries. So I'm totally into The Alienist and seeing what they do. Like the period ones I've really liked.
So, did you see it? Yeah.
I've been watching it, and I...
Two episodes in? Is that
I think it's... Is it two episodes? Yeah. I don't know. I've mixed... You guys haven't seen it, so it's hard to talk about it, but and I won't spoil it, but it's a dense story.
Okay.
And I'm not sure about the casting. I'll say some of the people I like. I mean, I love Dakota Fanning, but I don't know if I love her in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people just look period and some people just don't.
Oh, yeah. I struggle with that with movies sometimes, period piece movies. It's not uncommon. I remember that was my first problem with Preacher. There's just certain things where I was like, at one point, even with the main character, I was like, oh, I just don't know if that's the guy.
And, you know, yeah, like, I like him, but he's not Jesse to me.
Yeah, that and it can stop you from, you know, casting's everything.
One of my problems with The Deuce is because it was, have you seen The Deuce?
I have.
Some of it I absolutely love, like Maggie Gyllenhaal's character, I absolutely love. I thought there was a bit too much Franco because there was
double Franco.
Double Franco. You've been double Franco'd.
Yeah.
Continuing.
Why isn't that a phrase?
Well, that cost him the Oscar. Too much double Franco.
Double Franco.
There's a lot of complaining.
Bazing. But, you know, some of the characters I absolutely loved in that, like Maggie Gyllenhaal's character and some of the other prostitutes I loved, some of the people in the porn world, but then some of the gangsters I just didn't buy. I mean, like there were certain elements of it that it just didn't feel time period to me, and that pulled me out of it a lot. So,
tough.
It was mixed for me.
Tough.
Yeah. Tough to pull on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Inside Psycho and Inside the Exorcist is you could find it wherever you find podcasts. It's on Wondery. You can find it on iTunes.
Tell him we sent you so he knows
sent you.
That, you know, there's a reason for him to spend
this
time.
You can marathon them. You can listen one a day, one a week, whatever you want to do. It is available for you. There's even bonus content. There might even be a chat with me and Mark in the Inside
there
Psycho.
There might
be. I forgot we did a bonus episode.
Yes, we did.
But it's excellent, and I was really happy you were able to come and do with us today. Because we do love the show, and we're looking forward to whatever the next inside
is, something
inside ... to be revealed soon. We may have said it during the show. Who knows?
We may have.
Ooh.
We may have. Let's
I think
just
we
put
should.
It out
let's
there.
Start an office pool on what it will be.
We'll be taking
the only clue is Natasha Henstridge, Ice Cube, and Pam Greer.
So
where else can you get this?
I am so shocked
inside
you're not
Ghost
pushing
Mars is
for
coming.
Possession.
No, it's inside that's too easy.
That's
plus, I'm going to make that one.
He's going to do Inside Possession.
I thought you were going Species. For
yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah,
I did too.
He is the pretty.
That would be Alfred
fan.
Molina. All right.
But thank you, Mark, and we'll see you guys next week.